Let's go ahead and have everybody take their seat. We just went live on the internet. It's a little bit after 6 o'clock, and we're here in the State Capitol Building and Pier. And this is the final of four public input hearings that we have had on the proposed Keystone XL pipeline. I'm sure a lot of you know, but there is a tremendous amount of information on the PU's website on that project, and that website is puc.sd.gov. The complete application and all the pre-filed testimony for all the parties is available on that website. I'm Dusty Johnson. Joining me up here are my colleagues, Commissioner Steve Kolbeck and Commissioner Gary Hansen. And we are the three statewide elected utility commissioners for South Dakota, and ultimately we'll have to rule on this permit. Generally, we say that the commission has three options. We can approve the permit, we can deny the permit, or we can approve the permit with certain conditions that we feel are necessary to protect a whole slew of things, safety, the orderly development of the region, and those things are spelled out in statute. And if you've got questions on those, we'd be happy to talk about them. Also up here in the front is Commissioner Advisor Greg Ryslov. Mr. Ryslov has been with the commission for quite a number of years, 30 years or so, and advises the commission on policy matters and economic matters. We've got commission counsel, General Counsel John Smith. He's an attorney, and he advises us on legal issues. Also, we've got a court reporter up here, and Sherry is going to be taking down everything we say tonight. So we're going to ask that when you come up to these microphones, you first make sure that the green light is on. And it's a pretty green, it's a pretty bright light, so sometimes it looks like it's on even when it's not. So press it, even if you think it's on, press it one time, and so we can make sure that mic is on so that, A, people on the Internet can hear you, B, we can all hear you, and C, that we can transcribe this, we can have this entered into the official record of this proceeding. We also have the staff of the Public Utilities Commission. And whereas Mr. Ryslov and Mr. Smith are really just talking to commissioners and advising us, the staff is a separate party to the case. They're putting on their own case. They're calling their own witnesses. They are cross-examining the applicant's witnesses. Kara Semler is an attorney. Tim Binder is an analyst. Stacy Splitstoser and Nathan Solom are engineers and pipeline safety experts with our staff. And I also believe Mr. Bob Knadel is there as well. Mr. Knadel, another analyst. We've got Anissa Grambler with the office, who's handling some of our AV needs. And I think that is the commission staff in place. Maybe before we go any further, Mr. Kennecke, if you just want to quickly introduce some of the members of your team here.
Yes, thank you, Commissioner. With me tonight is Robert Jones, Vice President of TransCanada. Steve Hicks will be construction manager for the XL project. Jim White is an Associate General Counsel of TransCanada. In the back, we have Paul Fuhrer, who's a construction manager for the current Keystone project. We've got Buster Gray here, who's also in construction management for the current project. And Sarah Metcalf, who's the PUC liaison to the project.
Great. Thanks very much. All right, now, let's hear from you all. We're going to allow a certain amount of informality to reign here because I know most of you are attorneys. I'm not an attorney. We want to have some structure, but ultimately don't get too nervous about the legal formalities. I mean, we'll try to guide you, and if, you know, you've got questions, feel free to ask them. What we want to do is take some of the shorter comments or questions first, so that if somebody's got a big, long, you know, a longer speech, that we don't have everybody here have to wait for that. If you just want to say your piece and hit the road, we understand. So we'll take shorter comments first, and we'll kind of progress through that. If you've got questions or issues that need to be addressed by TransCanada, I don't have any problem giving them an opportunity if you've got something you want them to address right then. I also don't want to bog down the meeting too much. I don't want to keep all you guys here real late. So what I'm going to ask is that TransCanada try to keep their answers relatively short. And if they can't answer your question in a few minutes, then I'm going to ask them to hold that over toward the end of the meeting so we can hear from as many of you who want to hit the road as possible. And then obviously we're going to make sure we get, you know, the full answer, even if it can't fit within 3 minutes, but we're going to try to take that a little bit later, so we're respectful of all of you all's time. Again, when you come up here, we'd like to hear your name, We'd like to hear your town, and we'd like you to spell your last name so that our court reporter can get that. We want you to speak slowly and clearly, and it's amazing. So many of us get up toward a mic and we start, you know, talking really fast. And so just try to take a couple of deep breaths, and even, you know, professional witnesses today really got moving pretty fast once they got in front of a mic, so it makes it easier if we can all slow down. With that, I'm going to pause, see if Mr. Islov, Mr. Smith, or my colleagues have anything else to add. With that, let's go ahead and we can take questions or comments. Come on up. You don't have to be recognized by me. Just go ahead and grab the mic, and if we have a fight, go ahead. That'd be fine. If we have a fight for the mic, then we'll let the biggest guy take it first.
Okay, now it's on. Thank you. My name is Bev Tucker. I'm a Haakon County resident north of Phillip. Pipeline goes through about a mile and a quarter of my place in two different areas. I've got three concerns. I've got written remarks. I'll leave when I'm finished, which will include my name and contact information. First is peculiar to my place. The first section is native prairie, and it'll go through. So by definition, remediation is not really possible when you're going through native grasslands. Secondly, the proposed compensation scheme that I've heard ever since the pipeline has been announced seems quite strange to me, the concept of surface acres that you can take a strip 50 feet wide through a section of land and multiply 50 feet by 5,000 feet and get 6 acres of ground. I realize this is an issue for eminent domain and compensation, but just for the commission's interest, this seems like a completely strange way to look at it. And I would just offer for people who live in towns and have backyards, you know, would you sell off a strip through your backyard to somebody for 20 years for the same thing that the lot is worth? And that's the concept that's at play here. And there's some other ways to look at the compensation issue, either per foot. The pipeline goes through 300 miles in South Dakota, and it's going to cost about $900 million, so it's about $3 million a mile. It seems to be reasonable that the landowner would get some small but fraction of that $3 million a mile for the right to go through his ground. That's going to be a lot bigger number than 6 acres at $1,000 an acre or something, or whatever land is worth. So, or the revenue from the pipeline, which is a taxable income coming to South Dakota, a fraction of that annually is another, could be another component of compensation. I hope the commission will set some kind of safeguard mechanism, realizing that the individual landowner is one person with legal fees, and the pipeline is a huge entity with, for all practical purposes, unlimited resources when compared to one individual landowner. So there needs to be a mechanism, you know, a reasonable mechanism, so that if there are transgressions on agreements or legitimate grievances, they can be addressed reasonably. Thank you.
Well, I don't know if anybody could have done much better than you did, Mr. Tucker. That was great. Very specific areas of concern put very succinctly. That is a great model. Applicant, you know, TransCanada, you're going to need to step up. I'm not going to, if they don't ask for an opportunity, a specific answer from you, I'm not going to give you one. But if you bark up, you know, we may give you some time. But otherwise, I'm not going to give you time every time. But, and you've got written comments, Mr. Tucker. Commissioners, any questions or okay? Rather massive oversight on my part. Ms. Deb Gregg is the director of our Consumer Affairs Division. Ms. Gregg, go ahead and stand up and give a wave if you would back there. Ms. Gregg is not part of the staff team assigned to this particular docket, but does get very involved anytime there's a consumer complaint, really about any of the areas of jurisdiction over the commission. So, okay, good. Other comments? Or questions?
Okay. My name is Lon Lyman, L-Y-M-A-N, and I live 10 miles straight north of Okotin, South Dakota, up on Dry Creek. My parents and grandparents have been there 100 years. My wife's family, the Iverson family, has been in Jones County over 100 years. We're good stewards of the land. We always have been, and we try to be. And I have some real concerns about TransCanada. One of the main ones to begin with is I don't trust them. From very definite things that they've done and told me and then changed their mind and jerked us around. And mainly, a lot of my concerns are environmental concerns. And I'm going to ask these questions for the board, and I hope, I don't need an answer tonight, but I hope you gentlemen will definitely consider these things. We live up on Dry Creek. They have to cross Dry Creek with this pipeline. I tried to talk to them about crossing these banks because they're like the Bad River. They're 20-foot drops on both sides. I had a way figured out that they could go across there. They wouldn't have to do that. They gave me their word that they would do that. They've changed it twice since. I won't let them go across there. I did let their surveyors walk through there, but they said they were going to go there. Well, once they got down in there, they found out what it was really like. And if there were to be a leak, it would go right down Dry Creek, dump into Bad River, and be down here before you knew it. Okay, my questions are, and I'll try and be brief, will the land be repaired to its original contour, and will that be maintained as this packs down? Because Dry Creek has all creeks that run periodically, change the channels, wash trees down there, and absolutely change things around. And if they cut these banks down, or however they're going to go through a 20-foot bank on both sides, I don't see how you're going to keep that the way it was originally. The next concern is, will the topsoil, when they go through there, be set aside and replaced, reseeded to what grass was originally there? Because this is prairie grass. They're going through where it has never been farmed, never been touched. And in Jones County, if you tear up a bunch of ground, then you get Canadian thistles like you can't believe. Very big concern of ours. Another concern is, this work going to be done when we have a year like this, when it's so wet you can't hardly drive across there with an ATV or go through there with a saddle horse? Are they going to go through there then, or are they going to wait until we would go as good stewards of the land and not tear this up and not track it up and make ruts and so on? We have to live there. We have to be there year-round. How about crossing fences? They must cross me 4 or 5 times. Are those fences going to be repaired to their original condition? Because I'm very, very, you can ask my neighbors, I'm really tough on fences. And I want those fences right. If they go through there, are they going to put in gates where they go through? Or are they going to drop that fence every time they have to go through that easement? Are they going to put those gates in there? A decent gate. Will we, as landowners, have the right to use the surface of this easement in any way if it doesn't affect the pipeline? Because I've got pastures. They're going to go right through the middle of my pastures. And I got cabin pastures where they're going to be, the cattle will be on one side and then on the other. And are they going to fix this so that these cattle can go back and forth without having problems? Are we going to be reimbursed for this grass? And are they going to put in native grass when they come back in? The grass that was there. I don't want something else. I want the native grass, because that's what grows, and I don't have to fight Canadian thistles all the time. Are we going to, as landowners, be contacted if they do go in there and spray with what herbicides they're going to use? Are we going to know what they're going to put on this ground? Because I don't agree with a lot of the stuff that we do, the chemicals that we put on our ground anymore. And I'd like to know that. What are they going to dump on there? Are they going to kill the ground? You can do that. There's a lot of trees down in Dry Creek. Are we going to be compensated for moving those trees around? And those trees are what holds that ground so that we don't have a dry creek is getting wider and deeper, and the trees are what's holding that soil to what we have. Are they going to be responsible for any damage caused directly or indirectly by the installation, operation, and maintenance or removal of this pipeline at some time? Who's going to be responsible for that? All this maintenance and go, if that soil goes in the ditch and they put it in when it's wet, it's going to sink. They're going to go back in there and refill those like we have to do when we put in a pipeline. I'm also concerned about the length of time that this pipeline is going to be in there. How long are they going to keep it in there? And if they go and it's full of that oil and that thing leaks, then who cleans that up? I'm sure you gentlemen don't want another wharf resources that they had out in Rapid City. We're still cleaning that thing up at Lead. The other thing is that I don't believe that we should be subject to a foreign government. These people are not Americans, they're Canadians. This is an American company. We aren't going to get anything out of this in the end. That oil will be sent someplace else. This isn't really, gentlemen, any good for our United States. It isn't good for the state. It isn't good for us as individuals. And I hope you fellows will really consider this before you turn them loose, because they have not dealt fairly with us. They haven't told us the truth. And depends on which one you talk to on which day, what's going on. I do thank you, gentlemen. This has been respectfully submitted. Thank you.
Wow, Mr. Lyman, there were a lot of really important issues to tackle there. Let's pause to see, applicant, did you want to respond to any specifically? He said he didn't need any answers now, but, I mean, I feel like some of these issues raised, there'll be some commonalities tonight. And I've got a list running, so if you want me to repeat them, that's fine. But
Commissioner, you and I probably have a similar list. I don't think it's reasonable for me to answer them all, because some of them are very specific, obviously, with Mr. Lyman's property and the crossing of Dry Creek. And I don't personally know the specifics with regards to that construction, but I can certainly address a number of his concerns. Now, excuse me, Commissioners, do you want me to speak from here, or do you want me to speak from...
That's fine by me, but...
It's okay. Good. Absolutely, in general, let's start with original contour. The pipeline, when it comes through, is going to follow the original contour. We have the ability to safely bend the pipeline, and when we do that, we can maintain the original contour of the land. Topsoil conservation, one of the best practices TransCanada has learned over its 50 years of experience is topsoil conservation. And there's construction techniques out there today that have certainly allowed us to improve the impact when a pipeline goes through an individual property. So topsoil conservation is absolutely critical and maintained. Native prairie is a challenge. We have a lot of experience working with native prairie, and we appreciate the concern with regards to noxious weeds once the pipeline's gone through, and we do certainly work with the local experts to make sure that we have the proper seed mix when we go to reseed these areas. Fences are all repaired to their original state, and if a landowner requests a gate, we certainly will put in a gate. One of the things that occurs is that when an easement is signed and executed, it really allows the landowner to continue to enjoy the land before we even arrived. And so when we talk about these different issues, one of the documents that is discussed with each landowner is a construction mitigation reclamation plan. And in this plan, we write down the issues with regards to fencing and livestock and such, and so those are addressed, and even how the topsoil is is to be handled as well.
And so, Mr. Jones, that would be by a property owner by property owner evaluation. You all will have a conversation with them about what they want to do with their cattle or fencing. Is that right?
That's correct, and that's why I wanted to respond generally, because many of the issues, of course, impact each and every landowner. And so there is individual needs, individual concerns for each and every landowner. One of the questions with regards to herbicides, so we too are very concerned with herbicides. We never use a herbicide to do noxious weeds without the permission of the landowner. Trees are only knocked down for access, for safety, and for maintenance. If we are doing what they call a directional drill around a large river, and typically large rivers have a lot of trees associated with them, then those trees aren't impacted. But along the right of way, we do have to knock down trees so we can access the pipeline visually from air patrol, or we need to walk it for maintenance. We are responsible for the life of the pipeline. So when asked about who's going to maintain it, if it there's slumping or there's settlement, TransCanada Keystone will be responsible for the ongoing maintenance of this pipeline.
So, but very specifically, the question was about, so who's going to pay for damage caused, by you all for maintenance or operation or construction? And who pays for any of that damage? I mean, is there a situation where you all would cause damage that you would not be on the hook to compensate?
No. There was a question with regards to us being a foreign company, and not true. Yes, we are a Canadian company, our head office, but the easement will be signed with a U.S. company. It's an LP based in U.S. The U.S. head office is Houston, and all the workers are going to be based here in the U.S., and certainly the ongoing operating staff will live right here in South Dakota.
Okay, thanks, Mr. Jones, for covering so many of those answers so quickly. I'm sure we did not, Mr. Lyman, get the questions answered to the kind of depth you want, so let's make sure to the extent that we need to in follow-up get you the answers, and if there's something they can't answer, you let us know. All right, other comments? Again, we've had a couple of good, relatively short ones, and they can be longer. We just want to save those for the end.
If it's green, it's on.
It kind of always looks on, so I think you want to hit it one time just in case.
Okay. My name is Paul Siemens. That's S-E-A-M-A-N-S. And I live at 27893 244th Street, Draper, South Dakota. The Keystone XL pipeline crosses 1.5 miles of my land south of Draper. I have registered as an intervener in the permitting process and have decided to register my concerns at tonight's meeting. I have some reservations whether my concerns will be adequately addressed in this permitting process. One of my major concerns with Keystone XL is what happens after the pipeline is abandoned. If the pipeline is not removed, it will rust, sinkholes will develop, and it will be a hazard to vehicles, livestock, and especially to people. Although TransCanada has stated they will follow the laws in place at the time of abandonment, I would rather see a fund established by TransCanada to pay for removal of the pipeline when the time comes. I would ask that you as commissioners require establishment of a bond for the removal of the pipeline as a condition to this permit. I also have a problem with TransCanada wanting a perpetual easement. I don't feel I should commit all future owners of my land to an easement with TransCanada or their successors. The easement should only be enforced until such time as the pipeline is abandoned. Perhaps the South Dakota legislature should establish a maximum easement length for pipelines of 99 years rather than allowing perpetual easements. On the subject of taxes to be paid by TransCanada to the counties, I feel TransCanada has been less than forthcoming. They are promising the affected counties large sums of tax money, but will not reveal how they arrive at these figures. Even the South Dakota Department of Revenue is reduced to make an assumptions in order to figure out the amount of taxes paid by TransCanada. Being interested in history, I would like to see a walking cultural resource survey conducted by an independent party and paid for by TransCanada. This would be to mark, protect old trails, homesteads, and Native American sites. Also, there should be a walking survey done by qualified biologists, as I have seen the somewhat rare burrowing beetles along the pipeline route south of Draper. In summary, I would like to express my appreciation to the PUC for this opportunity to make this statement. Thank you. Thank you.
Another great one, Mr. Siemens. Any questions? Is there anything you needed addressed tonight, sir? Mr. Siemens, anything in particular you wanted TransCanada to respond to tonight?
No.
Okay, then we will note your concerns, absolutely.
I'm sorry, Paul, you did ask about historical monuments and such like that. We do have experts that are going to testify before us tomorrow about that. SHPO's involved. That's the State Historic Preservation. Paige Hoskins, she does that. And then there are other agencies that in state government like DNR that are going to testify about issues like that. So,
thank you. My name is Shondell Brink. I am from Box Elder near Rapid City. My husband and I are parents of four young children. I was raised on a ranch where a portion of the pipeline will pass through. I am also on the board of directors for Breadroot, which is a natural foods cooperative in Rapid City. Our goal at Breadroot is to source as much locally grown food as possible. Our goal is to stay within 100 miles, if possible. We are very, very concerned about the quality of our food source and the water that is, of course, available to the growers. With over 1,000 active members at Breadroot, we show with our dollars how important and how upset we would be if our local food source was contaminated because of a leak or other problem with this pipeline. I do understand you are not responsible for overseeing the pipe thickness, but it is a grave concern of ours. So please, please take into consideration before you approve any type of a waiver or something for this project to continue about that thickness. I am very passionate about the health and wellness of my family and of all citizens of South Dakota. And as elected officials, please, please exercise the stewardship of your responsibility to protect my family's land from encroachment of the contaminants and of our precious resources. Thank you.
Could you spell your first name, please?
It's C-H-A-N-D-E-L-L-E.
Thank you.
And it's B-R-I-N-K. Thanks.
Very articulate, Ms. Brink. Thanks. Anything from commissioners? Okay. Other comments?
Shandell, you had mentioned a waiver that's on the PHMSA side. I think we wouldn't actually issue a waiver. We would either say yes, no, or add things, conditions. We wouldn't waive any conditions. So just to clarify that. So
yes, just on that. As you know, that in order to request a design factor change with PHMSA, which, by the way, is the federal regulator for pipelines under the Department of Transportation, we have to go well above and beyond the current regulations and codes. And PHMSA has only authorized such a waiver to show that the pipeline would even be safer under this condition than otherwise in the standard code. So I just want folks to realize that it actually improves the safety of the pipeline.
Just as one additional point of clarification, that waiver has not been granted for this Keystone XL pipeline yet. It is granted by the federal government if it's to be granted, but that they have not finished their review yet. So it's worth noting your points are very well taken. Thank you.
And just one more point. The waiver is for the difference in size of the waiver is 1/20 of an inch. That's the size.
Okay, other questions? Or comments? Or concerns?
My name is John Harter, H-A-R-T-E-R.
Mr. Harter, I wonder if we've got your mic on there.
It's bright green.
Is it? Okay.
Okay. Before coming here, I was given a list of what the PUC could not make decisions on. I think our state leaders are passing their responsibility that they're elected to do. The PUC has the power to say no to the pipeline if federal laws and regulations won't protect our state. Our state legislatures and governor have put our water supply in danger, to my opinion, twice already on a large scale with Keystone One pipeline and underground lab in the gold mine in the Black Hills. We're better to have a dump site out of the public's eye than in an old gold mine. In my opinion, this could happen, accidental or on purpose. Now you want to screw up the center part of the state. TransCanada's own expert witness testified that Tripp County, with the High Plains aquifer, is highly permeable. Where the pipeline crosses my land, the City of Clome's water aquifer comes out into my land, according to a map shown to me by TransCanada's survey crew, land agent, and engineer. The distance between the pipeline and the aquifer is less than an estimated 100 yards. I did not measure this when they are out setting the points of the survey. The distance between the aquifer and my dugout is 1/8 mile or less. The pipeline will be less than 200 foot from my new well. The pipeline cannot be placed across my land without endangering an important water resource. You need to get stuck in your brains that our water source is more valuable than any amount of oil for any reason. It would make common sense not to endanger our water resources all over our state. Other important points on my land besides the high water table are the land is highly erodible blow sand, and reclamation is a key issue. I don't see how it can be pastured until it is completely sodded back in. I estimate myself that this will take a minimum of 2 to 5 year timeline. And that's because if you run the cattle on the area where the pipeline's been dug in, it's going to break the grass down and cause it to start blowing. There are cultural and historic resources that need to be inventoried by an independent expert parties and avoided or addressed. I have found numerous pieces of petrified wood and a tooth from an animal too large to be from a cow. Also, my mother told me that arrowheads were found in the area. This is when she was a child. It would make common sense to make sure that the first pipeline, Keystone One, works safely before cramming another pipeline down landowner taxpayers' throats, especially in light of recent press reports that call into question Keystone XL's construction schedule. When any citizen of our state wants to use property of another owner, they have to pay rent for every day it's used. TransCanada, a foreign-owned company, is being treated better than our own citizens because they do not have to meet this standard. It would make common sense to treat our landowner, tax-paying citizens equally, if not better, than a foreign-owned company backed by more foreign money. We are looking at returning an estimated $55 million in contractor excise tax money to TransCanada. Has anyone been smart enough to figure out what this money would do if it was returned to South Dakota citizens? This is simple math. $55 million times a 7 times turnover factor equals $385 million. $385 million times 4% sales tax equals $15,400,000 in revenue to our state. Take care of our South Dakota citizens. It does pay. TransCanada can not even get their lies straight between their own expert witnesses. They have to bring in an expert witness to refute what other expert witnesses say when it does not fit their agenda. For example, Heidi Tilquist testified that the chance of a pipeline incident is no more than one spill in 7,400 years in a given mile, and if a spill did occur, it would be 3 barrels or less. The Pipeline Hazardous Materials Safety Administration reported for the years 1986 through 2007 that the average oil spill in the U.S. was 902 barrels. That's one spill, 902 barrels, or 37,868 gallons of oil per spill. This is a long ways from 3 barrels. A friend told me an old saying. It says, figures lie and liars figure. I found this to be quite fitting to this example. It would be a nice change to see our government bodies look after its fellow taxpaying citizens instead of crawling in bed with big money oil companies or just big money companies to boot. We have the power to make change in our federal laws and to keep our state safe, healthy, and beautiful. All we have to do is say no until the changes are made that benefit all and not just the rich and greedy. This is the responsibility that you, the PUC, were elected to do by the people. I'd like you to remember this as you're making your decisions on this oil line. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Luke 6:31. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Harder. We're going to allow some leeway in people talking about things like taxation policy and easements. We've allowed that because I don't want to make anybody nervous about what they can legally talk about. But try to keep it tight because there's really, I mean, we don't set taxation policy. I know you know that, and we're certainly going to keep your comments, and we'll take them under consideration because I think it's all part of the big economic and environmental picture we're trying to look at. I do think we can probably make our points without insulting people, saying that people are rich and greedy. Maybe people are, maybe they aren't. Saying that our elected officials have crawled into bed with foreign corporations. Maybe some have, maybe some haven't. I just think your concerns are your concerns. They're very legitimate, and I don't know that any of us need to resort to insults tonight to make our point. So other questions or comments for Mr. Harder with regard to his comments? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anybody with comments, 3 minutes or so? Again, we'll hear from everybody. I don't want to, you know, we'll take long comments, but I want to make sure we are respectful of people's time. Go ahead, sir.
I'm Dwayne C. Vig, Mud Butte, South Dakota. Landowner on a 100-year ranch at TransCanada Keystone XL. We'll cross our hayfields. Just for thought purposes, a gentleman from TransCanada said he chose not to be specific, and I agree. I'll let him be general at the end of my comments here. The rancher is the original environmentalist. We proved our land stewardship in the last 100 years. TransCanada has a burden of proof of trust. If there's anything I get out of this, and I could say more, a lot of the comments already have covered, so it'll save us some time. But proof of trust is a concern to me, and if the gentleman chooses to answer it, that's certainly up to him. In 2008, we first came in contact with land agents from TransCanada. We trustingly signed a survey form. Less than 24 hours later, the trust was broken by TransCanada. They chose to drive across and trespass with unauthorized vehicles that we had not authorized on the survey form. Not much to say, but TransCanada has proved to us that their understanding of trust, credibility, is nowhere near for those of us and our families, like I say, 4 and 5 generations, have been stewards of this land. Many of the comments are made tonight and questions and comments from the gentleman at the TransCanada table about what they would do, cover, pay for, take care of. We've got to remember trust. We live on trust and handshakes. And that may be too general for what you guys need to cover, but that's what concerns us. They've not been addressed to this day, those issues from 2008. Private property rights are as dear to us as our right to life. I've spoken to some of the TransCanada officials who call themselves upper management with the same disrespect, arrogance, right down the line to the fellows who walked on the ground, and we stopped them because they were trespassing with vehicles we'd not approved. So, to cut it a little bit shorter, we appreciate your efforts, citizens of South Dakota. We appreciate that you would not consider planning to permit this to go on in our state. No survey of our land, no environmental impact statements. To our understanding, has to be reviewed and discussed. None of that's happened. Locally, as you call, we've had about 10 years of really dry weather, except for the last two. Myself and every person alive out there has been fighting prairie fires. We have nice little fire departments. No plan whatsoever has been brought up about oil line fires. We can read on a computer, you can see quite often TransCanada oil leaks. As has been mentioned here tonight already, serious leaks, deaths involved. So, our closest fire departments that might even be close to handling an oil line fire would be over 2 hours away. And yes, they could say we could come in and we'll train your people. We have ranching duties. We do not have time. We're glad to fight our prairie fires. We do not have time to fight oil line fires. Never been discussed or reviewed. So if the gentleman cares to answer, rebuilding trust, that would be pleasant. Trust or lack thereof. Thank you for your time. I'll make one comment. Dakota Rail Action has been a godsend help for us to keep us focused with information and direction. And I would like to be here every day, visit with you people, and help you out and get you information. But we've got ranching duties. Thank you very much, sir.
Mr. Vig, how do you spell your last name?
V-I-G. V as in Victor, I-G. D-W-A-Y-N-E for the first name.
And you may have said that already. Sorry.
No, I didn't. I'm sorry. I apologize.
Did TransCanada apologize for
No, sir.
Bringing unauthorized vehicles on your property?
No, sir.
Mr. Jones, I don't expect you to know the details of this situation. You're dealing with, you know, hundreds, maybe thousands of landowners along the route. But just as a suggestion, you know, if I were you, I'd want my people to look into this. And if an apology is in order at some time in the next few days and weeks, I think that'd be appropriate.
It's been brought to attention, and Mr. Calhoun, are you familiar with his name? From Kansas City?
Yes, sir.
He was out. One of the most disrespectful men that I've ever met with at the level he claims to be. And there was ladies present, and I won't even go into how disrespectful he was. Thank you for your time.
Well, and I'm not going to make you go into that on the record. I do think, you know, if Mr. Calhoun, who, you know, we've met, if he has been or he has presented to the, you know, to the commission at many of the public input hearings he's been at, I mean, if he has been rude, I mean, if I were you, I would take an opportunity during a break or at the end to let the applicant know specifically in instances. I mean, I always think more information, more formally presented can help us do our job better and them do their job better. But
he has without it.
Perfect. Other,
no, I would say that's a perfect comment. You've got an instance, you've got a name, you're on record with it. That's exactly what we need. Thank you.
Thank you all.
Commissioner Jones, can I?
Sure, go ahead, Mr. Jones.
I certainly can tell Mr. Vig right now that the apology, he doesn't have to wait too long for that apology. I'm absolutely willing to give it to him right now. Trespassing is absolutely not acceptable. And I, too, would feel a trust is broken if someone had indicated that they were going to do something and they did something else. So I do apologize for Mr. Calhoun's behavior. He is a contractor with us. In fact, I'm pretty certain he no longer works for us, but I will confirm that with the commission. And so I understand Mr. Vig's frustration, and I do apologize. I think a lot of folks need to recognize that a formal environmental impact statement is being conducted under the auspices of the Department of State. It is an extremely lengthy and comprehensive assessment that they do. Many, many independent experts are involved, and certainly when you look at a public utility such as this pipeline, we recognize that it is new to a lot of people, and whether it's a power line or a railway or a pipeline, there are a lot of issues and concerns. I want also people to recognize that an oil spill response plan will be established for this pipeline. It will be approved by the Department of Transportation. And there is absolutely no expectation that the local fire department will fight an oil spill. We've talked about everything we do to make sure that never, ever happens. But if in the likely event it did and there was a fire, we absolutely have no expectation the local fire department would have to do anything there outside of protect the public. So I think there's sometimes a lot of misconception about what happens during an oil spill, and so we certainly work with the fire departments, the local fire departments, because we recognize that they have a role to play with regards to protecting the public. But again, Mr. Vig, I'm sorry about the event. I have now received confirmation that Dennis Calhoun has been relieved of his employment with the project.
Thanks, Mr. Jones. Any other brief comments? Sorry, Ms. Anderson, we'll get you up. We'll get you up next.
David Nemi from Harding County, South Dakota, NIEMI.
Before you go, Mr. Nemi, I do want to thank you for submitting some written comments in advance of this week's hearing. Those are very helpful for us to be able to have them in writing and in front of us in advance, and so thank you very much for your efforts there.
You're welcome. I have multiple miles of this line that is crossing my property, and along with that, pipelines need to have some safety measures that would help protect the property owners. One of those measures would be liability. Property owners need to be free of all pipeline liability, the spills, leaks, any damage that's done to property or to individuals should be the responsibility of the pipeline company. A farmer or rancher cannot afford the insurance requirements of a hazardous material spill that this foreign-owned pipeline would cause. Bonding is a condition that should be part of this permit. Those bonding requirements should be for the reclamation of surface damages. There should be the bonding requirement for the spills and when leaks occur. Property owners need to be compensated for the loss of crop and damages that occur when a pipeline would rupture. And bonding requirements should also be required for abandonment, that if or when this pipeline company declares insolvency, no property owner wants an abandoned gasoline station under their property. Bonding would provide a degree of protection for the property owners. This PUC permit should have a termination date. There should be no permanent perpetual easement. If this pipeline has a designated lifespan, it should also have a sunset clause on that agreement. Time has been taken away from each one of us, away from our business, to have to talk and visit with these foreign land agents that drive into the yard unannounced, the telephone calls that happen all hours of the day and night. I had a lady that called me after 10 o'clock at one evening that wanted to drop some paperwork off. I had mentioned to her that office hours Monday to Friday, 9 to 5, I would hope she could abide by that. The other annoying call I got was from Mr. Calhoun that was mentioned earlier, called me on Mother's Day. That's outright harassment. There should be no covenants or restrictions involving a property owner. There should be no restriction on travel or weight. After this pipeline's installed, we should be able to cross with any type of equipment that we need to conduct in a farming or ranching or even a construction operation. There should be no restrictions on development. If we want to put a housing development on a chunk of property, if it's somewhat adjacent to this line, we shouldn't have to call a foreign land to get an okay for that. Covenants could also result in a devaluation of property. If this property is devalued, that also affects our borrowing ability. Somewhere we would need to be compensated for that. There should be no restriction on hunting. In northwestern South Dakota, predator control is something we take very seriously. We hunt every waking minute of every day that we possibly can just for coyotes. And if we cannot control coyotes, we're out of the sheep business. And it's going to be affecting the cow-calf operator, and partially is already if you do pasture calving. There'd be no restriction on hunting. That would have a serious effect on us. Since 1992, there have been several significant paleontology specimens that have been unearthed off my property. Some of those have been prepared. They've been on a worldwide tour, mainly to Asia. Been back. Those are a very valuable resource. In Harding County, we ended up going to court action with TransCanada so we could have our cultural experts accompany the survey team as they went through the survey so we could identify what is visible so far. If this construction takes place, there is a need for a cease and a desist order on the pipeline construction if there is a specimen found until our experts can evaluate it. There is a need for annual compensation. there's going to be unwanted traffic, whether it be vehicle, whether it be on foot, or it's somebody doing surveillance by air. There's also going to be above ground fixtures that's going to be either signing for signs, going to be valves, whatever that's associated with this pipeline. If it's sticking out of the ground, it's an annoyance. It's in the way. If it is, we need to be paid annually for that. I guess that's all I have. Thank you for your time.
No, thank you, Mr. Namey.
Yeah, David, is there one thing or a couple things about your operation that concerns you the most? Would it be chisel plowing? Anything that you do on a normal basis that, you know, I want to make darn sure when I chisel plow that I'm not liable for that pipe. Is there anything like that specifically that you can think of? Normal, would you just call everything normal farming operations?
Yeah, to a degree. Where we're at in northwestern South Dakota and Harding County, why there is some oil and there's some gas developments going on and some potential uranium. And there is a lot of times testing and exploration techniques that take place, and that involves some very heavy equipment.
Okay.
And that line would need to be crossed if there is any, I'll say with heavy equipment, if there would be a weight restriction, you'd have to go to a safe harbor to get across. And if that being, that's going to be some distance away, it also takes time. Okay. Time's money.
That's exactly what I was looking for. Perfect. Thank you.
Yep.
Other comments? Ms. Anderson, we promised you next, so you were moving that way, and Mr. Newman was just a little faster on the draw, so.
Is there an extra seat that I could sit and show them as a...
Well, let's go ahead and pull one up here. We'll help you out. Thank you, Ms. Semler. We needed some Teamsters in here to... Welcome, Lillian. Go ahead.
Do I need to push? My name is Lillian Anderson. I'm from Langford, South Dakota. I'm a landowner along the Keystone One pipeline in northeast South Dakota. During the permit process of Keystone One, the PUC set conditions. Okay. During the, let's see. Shouldn't have done that. You set conditions for TransCanada when you give them their permit. One recent problem with the pipeline construction deals with condition number 34, which states construction must be suspended when weather conditions are such that construction activities will cause irreparable damage unless adequate protection measures approved by the commission are taken. From the beginning, one of our major concerns when the construction started was that the soil could not withstand machinery on it while it was wet. This is something I have... Okay. Okay, from the beginning, one of our major concerns when the construction started was that the soil could not withstand machinery when it was so wet. I testified to that to Keystone One hearings. During the construction, our fears were realized, and an exceptionally wet year has happened, causing problems with digging the land up to put the pipe in and reclaiming the black soil in the land afterwards. Actually, they quit constructing through our area and came back in January, and they dug it out in extremely hard, frozen soil, got down to where there was water, left it set for 2 weeks, and then put the frozen stuff back in, the frozen clay on top of the pipeline. On one of these days, this was later this spring, Kent Mackley, and the reason Kent is not here is because his sister has been very ill. A landowner by Britain went out to his land to stop the reclamation because this construction was in direct opposition of the conditions set by the PUC. While he was out on his land, Kent took this picture on October 2nd. I would call that adverse conditions to be putting ground back together. Later on the site, TransCanada employees told Kent that if he did not allow them, to finish with a reclamation, that he would be responsible for the reclamation bill. They set that piece of machinery in over 5 feet. That stuck. He got them stopped. We've had a discussion with this with Buster Gray, and he stopped the reclamation up on Kent's land. I have many more pictures which are far more graphic than that one is. The damage that the T-stone has done by putting our land back together when it was too wet all along this whole system is just unimaginable. They have been in water that they should have never been in. They've been on land with heavy machinery they should have never been on. And they have compacted the problem by mixing the soils. In many of these photos, you can see that it's topped, clear that the topsoil and clays were mixed. And that is also in direct opposition to the PUC's condition. Another problem that has occurred with the Keystone 1 construction is dewatering and drainage. In the fall of 2008, Keystone contractors dewatered wetlands and a pipeline easement. It is my understanding that they do not have to keep records of how much they pump, when they pump, and what the water condition is, whether it is alkaline or whatever. The DENR is not testing the water or watching water quality as they would if it was irrigation water. In 2008, they did quit after we complained, but they promised to be back in 2 weeks. There are other landowners that are not people that have pipelines on their land that are affected because they're pumping water downhill. Helms Construction or Helms Engineering from Aberdeen said water runs uphill in our country, but it doesn't seem to really. TransCanada, again, during October of 2009, dewatered the pipeline easement and flooded one farmstead and the land going to his farmstead and three other farmers. Buster Gray has agreed that damage was done and that TransCanada should be responsible for reimbursement of any damages done to landowners. As of yet, we have not submitted a bill. It is unfair and unreasonable that TransCanada can continue to destroy our land and crops while promising to do no damage and claim that they are good neighbors. During the construction process, this picture that he was just holding up is on Kent's, like a week ago, where they were draining water that they weren't supposed to be draining any water on his land, but they were draining water. Another problem is the damage to the roads. Oh, excuse me, I missed one. During the construction process, if you remember, we repeatedly mentioned the water in our area. TransCanada wound up putting cement saddles on the land, on all of the pipe going through our area. I can't remember right now exactly how many miles it is, but that's what the saddles look like that they've put on our, that was not planned for. Another problem that we have incurred with Keystone 1 construction is damage to the roads. That's a road on Kent's land. That's a land owned by Carpenter, or a road rather, excuse me, and that's another road by Carpenter. TransCanada continued to use roads when the conditions were such that they should not have had any equipment on them. Farmers do not use roads when they are wet because they have to pay taxes to make sure they are fixed. TransCanada used these roads when they were wet and they have severely damaged them. Although some payments have been made to townships for road damage, road conditions are still, still miserable. TransCanada's solution for this does not seem to go far enough. Complete road construction needs to be done. There is no base left in these roads. TransCanada has been working in our area after payments were made to our township. And it's my understanding that they have agreed that they will make restitution, but what they need more than money. They need to come and rebuild the roads. There's no road left. As a landowner of Keystone One, I would suggest that each township and county receive cash bonds until the construction company rebuilds the roads. The PUC should guarantee that Keystone will keep good records of water discharge, when, where, and the quality of the water. The PUC should also guarantee that no one should have to fight to have their land restored to precondition by following PUC condition number 34. In addition, any conditions put on this new pipeline need to be fully enforced. Roads used by Keystone XL should be maintained daily at the rate of construction with DOT oversight to ensure damage to the bases of the roads is not done. I would recommend inspectors paid for by TransCanada, but not working for them. They would be empowered to stop the work when construction violations occur by the company at each work site on each day. Thank you.
Yeah, sure. Let's go ahead and I'll tell you what. I'll tell you what, the best sight lines are if you actually come up right in between these two pieces of wood here. That way everybody on the sides gets a good look. And then if we could, and then you described the pictures already, Ms. Anderson. Why don't you go ahead and quickly give people another.
What do you want to do? Okay, this is a road by Carpenter.
Yeah, that's it's going to be a challenge for a lot of you to see that. Is it possible for you to have them? Well, there's a table in the lobby there, and everybody could, or pass them around. That way everybody could see them. It's going to be pretty challenging for a lot of these folks to see them there.
I'll tell you what, Commissioner Hansen, I think, has made a good suggestion. There's a description on each one of those. Let's go ahead and put them exactly as Commissioner Hansen suggested out there. That way you can get right up close and look at them, because I do think they're compelling photographs. And then if you've got questions, I'm sure Ms. Anderson will be around. And we won't go too much longer here before we'll need to take a break. I mean, not more than about another hour, I wouldn't think. So, or how much? Okay, we'll be taking a break in 20 minutes. So, Ms. Anderson, why don't you post yourself back near that table, and then if people have questions, they can ask you here when we take our break in 20 minutes. So. Okay, we're going to go ahead and pause. Okay, back on the record, and I would like to, sorry, Ms. Nimi, I don't want to put you off here, but I would like to have at least two things addressed by the applicant here. The first is condition number 34 of the first Keystone Pipeline, the wet weather cessation of construction activities. And then Ms. Anderson mentioned that Buster Gray had agreed that at some point TransCanada was at fault for something and there should be compensation. And if anyone knows the specifics of that situation, an update on that might be helpful.
Yes, Commissioner. There's a couple of things we could do to handle this. We do have some materials we'd like to present, but we think it's probably best done at the end. Let everyone here have an opportunity to speak, and then we'll present some information at the end. We obviously recognize that some of the most challenging conditions in the entire line were through Mr. Meckley's and Ms. Anderson's properties. I certainly could like to address a whole number of issues that she identified, but maybe the best thing to do is for us to present some of our responses towards the end of this session. For your guidance on
that. I think that's fine, but I think there's a lot of concern about wet weather construction. I was just reading body language of the crowd, and so that one in particular. I mean, why don't we talk a little bit about what your operating procedure was with the first pipeline, and if it deviated from the commission's order, I mean, obviously we want to know about that.
Yes, certainly I can I can address some of them right now, and I'd be glad to do that. I just don't want to take up too much time.
No, I understand. I don't want to slow down. People have got, you know, real lives going on either. But that one in particular, I think it will save time by answering people's questions.
Absolutely. Now, I appreciate there are environmental inspectors out there. They're independent of both TransCanada and the contractor, and their job is to shut down work as described. We certainly have seen a lot of water out there, and I think if you were to take a 360-degree picture, you would see virtually that area is entirely underwater. Just a couple of points. Winter construction is very effective in extremely wet conditions, and that's what we ran into, and so that worked very well, by the way. The cement weights that you saw, that is planned. That is not uncommon. When you've got high water tables, cement weights that are placed in the pipeline is extremely common practice, and makes for a continued safe operation of the land. As for the topsoil conservation, my understanding is that continues to be monitored by our folks, and we continue to meet our requirements there. Mr. Gray and Mr. Fuhr are here to answer specific questions about that site. That's why I brought them here today, because I have the gentlemen that are responsible for that construction to be here. In fact, Buster, do you want to add anything to my comments? Or wait till
I think your point about not trying to address everything is a good one, Mr. Jones. I was just wanted to give you an opportunity to specifically talk about to what extent construction activities cease during wet weather, because I think that's of broad concern to a number of folks. Everything else we take up later, I agree.
Fair enough. What's hard to see, of course, pictures can be a challenge at times, is that we have what they call construction mats. And what you didn't see in there was either the equipment wasn't properly placed on these mats or it has come off them. So we have built thousands of miles of pipeline this year and used tens and tens of thousands of these construction mats, and it's been very, very effective. But it certainly looks like at this situation that the equipment was no longer on that. But again, Mr. Fuhr and Mr. Gray can address the exact details with regards to that. But we do have inspectors on the site, and they do have absolutely the ability to shut work down when required.
In your opinion, and I know nobody's under oath here, but I mean, do you believe that TransCanada was in violation of the commission condition number 34 with regard to construction during wet periods?
No, I don't.
Okay. Go ahead.
Is this on?
I'm sorry. Commissioner Colbeck asked me to give him an opportunity to do something. I'm sorry.
I just wanted to, one thing that was addressed was what we do after the permit's been handled, and our staff has worked on these road conditions, and I was wondering if Kara, if you could, Ms. Simler, if you could give them just a little bit of lowdown on who you've contacted, how you contact them, and your process to handle complaints that you've received.
For roads specifically?
For roads specifically.
Commissioner, my name is Kara Semler, and I'm a staff attorney here at the PUC, and I work very closely with Deb Gregg, the manager of our Consumer Affairs Department, and excuse me, we have an 800 number. We really welcome the calls and enjoy helping consumers, so please do call if you have any questions or concerns. Now, with that being said, we did contact the highway superintendents for all of the counties down the route of the first pipeline. And those highway superintendents are the members of your community that do represent you regarding the condition of your roads, and they are the direct line to your local governments that can help you with your roads. And the report consistently from those highway superintendents was that the process is underway, and it is a process, just like we're seeing here today. It's a process to understand the level of damage, to obtain the proper engineering quotes, and the process is underway, and there wasn't a lot of dissatisfaction with the process. It is working. It taxes everyone's patience at times, and I appreciate that.
So, Ms. Simler, is it fair to say that there were at times, and may still be, dissatisfaction, maybe even significant dissatisfaction with those highway superintendents about the roads, the condition of the roads at that moment, mm-hmm. but that they felt like they were working through the process
yes.
to get those issues resolved.
I believe that is very accurate. They all definitely indicated that roads were damaged. And they also all indicated that TransCanada was working with them to understand the level of damage and to get those repairs made. So.
And I don't know the details, so I'm asking sincerely. I mean, have there been large monetary settlements that you're aware of between TransCanada and I don't need specifics, but I mean, have there been substantial payouts to pay for damages?
I don't know what large is because, you know, we don't have anything to, I guess, compare this to, but the number sure seemed big to me for, you know, relatively short amounts of road.
And one more thing, just to, we didn't have this luxury last time, but none of those payments affect the $12 million in bonding that we secured.
No, there have been no claims made on that bond. It's intact. And if ultimately this process does fail and these counties can't arrive at numbers they're happy with, that bond's intact, and it is there to protect the county infrastructure.
Thank you.
Thanks for your patience.
Sure.
Go ahead.
This is on, correct? Deborah Neamy, N-I-E-M-I.
And again, thank you, as I mentioned, to David Neamy. I appreciate your willingness to file pre-filed testimony in this proceeding.
Like my brother, David, told you, our grandparents homesteaded over 100 years ago on the ranch we grew up on. And first, my grandmother, she hauled her own water, provided her own shelter. A year later, my grandfather applied for his homestead next to hers. During my life, I've lived in the suburbs of a major metropolitan city. I've watched cornfields being tore up for some company's interests, and I felt the loss for the generations who had planted the corn and were good stewards of the land. I never thought in my lifetime that I would watch the same thing go on with my parents' ranch. My parents are alive, although they have difficulty speaking. In time, I could have more than a contingency interest in this property in the ranch. But I tell you the following to give you an idea of how this company acts. Last March, I wrote it on the ranch calendar, I came out of the ranch house, which is 4 miles north of Buffalo, and I saw my brother keeps the calves and the lambs in a lot, and because you feed, as any rancher would know, you keep the livestock close for shelter. You can feed them right there. All he has to do is go over a cattle guard to go to them. They were running for their lives. My mother described it as scaring the tar out of them. I'm not sure she said the word tar, but anyway. I went out of the house to see what was going on, and I heard this sound. It was a sound like none other. And I looked up, and it looked like it was this huge eight-person helicopter about down on our garage, the garage that sits out at the ranch. And I felt like I was in a Harrison Ford movie. I thought, how strange that there would be a helicopter here because they had not contacted us. We did not know that they were coming. And the helicopter coming to the ranch is a rare event. I mean, it has happened. I won't say that hasn't happened. They've landed. They gave us notice, and it was at the appropriate time of the year. It wasn't when we had livestock in close. Along the same line, at the PUC meeting in my hometown of Buffalo that you were there, a break was called, and Mr. Jones, you'll remember, he came over to me. He sat in front of me, and he asked me why I was so interested in their financial position. And I stated because it was due to the 2008 debt service coverage ratio, and it's more than enough to make your eyes bulge, or something to that effect. I'm not sure I said bulge, but anyway. All of us know what amount was left after they paid their tax or their debt service payments in 2008. And to think I had read this, I'm not sure I believe everything I read, but they have a $22 billion capital project program going on. And this, I don't mean, give me a word or two here, but the quote or the question that came from Mr. Jones to me was, I'll have you know that our company made $3 billion with a B last year, meaning in 2008. And like I say, it was within a word or two, and he could probably tell you exactly what the quote was. And I said, well, how interesting is that? The annual report I read says $1,440,000,000, and that was before the debt service payments. Also, the way I felt about it was he was just telling me something I wanted to hear. Does he tell you that, too, just whatever you want to hear? And prior to that meeting, when you guys came to my hometown of Buffalo, the Secretary of State's office held their scoping meeting there. In fact, it was in the same place, the rec center. And I asked Elizabeth Orlando at that meeting about the financial condition and if we as landowners end up with NSF check or a white elephant. And she said, that's not my department. That's your state commission. They are approving this permit. And so they will be the responsible party. And I will tell you, I know what you can do about it. I spent every morning in appropriations one legislative session. I think it may be in this room, although it's been remodeled since I was here last. And I guess lastly, and it's more rhetorically, you don't have to answer me, but I've been reading about Spink County and what their commissioners have been going through. And I would just think that one nightmare in South Dakota is enough.
Thanks very much, Ms. Nemi. Mr. Jones, did you want an opportunity?
Please.
Is that okay, Ms. Nemi?
Yeah, okay, go ahead. Thank you, Commissioner. I have two comments. First, I did go and talk to Ms. Nemi, and I was trying to help her with regards to the annual report. I noticed she had it in her hands. And we were, I was trying to explain the difference between revenue and returns. I think the comfort she can have is that TransCanada, a corporation, which is listed on the New York Stock Exchange and is listed on the Toronto Stock Exchange, continues to be an A-grade credit company. We are a utility company, which means we take a very low risk outlook when it comes to our investments. There's no doubt there continues to be a need for utilities, and so we do have a large program in place. We talked about a number of things, like the companies that were involved in our debt and how much debt we had raised. And
Ms. Jones, I don't want to cut you off, but given the number of people here, I want to give you an opportunity to respond, but if it can be like this rather than like this, that'd be great.
Sorry, thank you, Commissioner. Just wanted to put in context my conversation, and just because it does deal with me personally, that's why I'm fairly passionate about responding to it. The other thing, of course, I do not know and never have heard of this incident, but I certainly do apologize for the helicopter incident, and I will personally investigate what happened there.
Okay. I know you're up at the mic, but our court reporter has asked for a break, so if that's acceptable to you, we're going to go ahead and hold you over. And I would think, 10 minutes, you know, I was going to say 10, but there aren't a lot of bathrooms on this floor. So let's go ahead and make it 15, but let's make that a hard 15. And so at 22, we will start. Okay? Thank you. And with that, we will be off the web, but we'll come back on the web at 22. Okay. We're going to go back on the web. All right, we will just remind everybody, speak slowly, speak clearly, say your name and location, spell your last name, and if you've got comments that are shorter in nature, let's take you first so we can get you back on the road if you want to get back on the road. And with that, unless any of my colleagues have anything to add to improve from the first session, go ahead and begin, sir.
Yes, my name is John Iverson, I-V-E-R-S-E-N. I'm from Myrtle. Keystone comes across about a mile, my ranch. We're about 5 miles east of Myrtle. It's already been addressed, but I'm going to address it again, is the perpetual easements. I don't know how you can let a foreign company come in here and just absolutely take our land. Very much against that. Also, I guess I don't think they're very trustworthy either. I read their pamphlets. So I guess, first of all, all the testimony you hear from them is they're experts. They own them. I mean, they're paying them. Makes me a little bit nervous. I've got all their pamphlets last month or 6 weeks or whatever. I mean, I could just about burn my furnace all week or all month or all year with a lot of it. But one thing, and I'm going to be honest, I never read it all. I read a lot of it. After a while, it just got to be pretty much all the same. I mean, they kind of sidestep the issues. They don't really tell the truth. They tell you what they think you want to hear. After a while, I just kind of, you know, to me, it was all the same. Pretty much the same business. But, and I had one other thing, but I can't think what it was. I guess I'd like to know who's the president of that company and what capacity and where he resides. I would like to know, and it comes from a pretty good source, and I don't know, I can't divulge names, but it was told to me that they purchased just about all the pipelines and lines that they own. They built very few of them. I guess I'd like a response to that, and how much they built or actually not bought, how much they've actually physically built, like this one down in eastern South Dakota. And I guess that's about all I have to say.
Very good, Mr. Iverson. Thanks. Let's... Mr. Jones, why don't you describe who's the president of this, of the applicant, and then how many miles of pipeline has that entity or its affiliates built miles of pipeline?
Thank you, sir, for your questions. The president of TransCanada Keystone is a gentleman named Mr. Russ Gerling. And Keystone today has approximately 2,000 miles that we've constructed, and oil is scheduled to start operation by the end of the year.
What about, you know, parent company?
Yes, so TransCanada Corporation owns a number of pipelines in the United States and operates a number of them, including well over 20 years here in South Dakota, the Northern Border Pipeline. We have a maintenance office in Brookings, and we have well over 40,000 miles of pipeline operation throughout North America.
Mr. Iverson asked specifically about miles of pipeline constructed by this company or its parent. Of that 40,000, how many were constructed by you all?
I don't have the number on top of my head, but I would estimate about half of that.
Okay.
We're probably now the largest pipeline company in North America, and very few pipeline companies have constructed as much large diameter pipelines as we have.
So I'm not trying to nail you down to a specific figure, but it wouldn't be unreasonable for someone to presume that TransCanada may have constructed as much as 20,000 miles of pipeline in recent decades.
I'd have to confirm that number, but that wouldn't be unreasonable.
And this, the president of Keystone, the applicant, Russ something, and where does he live? That was another question Mr. Iverson asked. His place of residence.
Mr. Gerling's place of business is in Calgary, and he's the president not only of Keystone but of all the pipelines in the TransCanada owns and operates.
Great, thanks very much. And then, go ahead.
I guess that answers pretty much all my questions. In a worst scenario case for me, if you would decide to grant them a permit, I hope you also do it with a lot of conditions. And I hope maybe down the road, if you do that, I hope that you will give some of the landowners maybe a chance to an informal roundtable to visit and maybe pass some ideas around if that's possible.
It's a good suggestion, Mr. Iverson. Thanks.
Yep, thank you.
Next up, and while we're having somebody come up, Mr. Iverson raised, I think, a very, very legitimate issue, which is, hey, listen, are all the experts testifying on this stuff paid for by TransCanada? And the answer to that is yes, although not all of them were working for TransCanada. Commission staff has called a number of expert witnesses from across the country to testify on this. Those witnesses are paid for by TransCanada through a filing fee they have to pay with the commission, but those experts don't correspond with TransCanada except through the normal legal channels. They are working for staff to really vet and question, ask the same kind of questions you're asking. So, very good point. Okay, go ahead, sir.
My name is Peter Larson. I'm a geologist and paleontologist with Black Hills Institute of Geological Research in Hill City, South Dakota. And we've been working scientifically in Harding County since 1992, working on the Nemi Ranch and other ranches around the county. I am an expert in paleontology, but I am not paid by the TransCanada, nor am I paid by anyone else. I am here as well as my people have been working on this project in defense of the fossils and that are very abundant in Harding County and elsewhere throughout the state. It's interesting that I was only allowed, I was allowed to accompany the pipeline survey crew, I and five of our people, as they worked through Harding County. They also, in Harding County, hired a consulting firm to look at paleontology, and that's, as far as I know, the only place that they looked at paleontology. And it was done only because the ranchers in that county actually brought legal action to allow me to accompany that pipeline, and they spent literally thousands of dollars of their money to make sure that paleontology was looked at. I have some statements, a couple of letters that I have sent to various people during this process, and I'd like to give those to you before I leave the podium. In working in Harding County, we did actually a map here that I'm including as well of a portion of Harding County, which shows the extreme density of fossil sites that are found just on one ranch alone, and it lists the various fossils that were found there. Through following the pipeline survey crew, it's important to note that there is only about 5% of that land which actually goes through exposures of the Hell Creek Formation, but more like 90% of the county where we go through the Hell Creek Formation, which is one of the most important time frames in terms of the science of paleontology. It helps us to understand about global climate change. This is the period surrounding the impact of this giant asteroid that occurred about 65 million years ago. And we're still learning a tremendous amount about what effect that had on life forms here on Earth, which is very important in our understanding as to what damage we can be doing to the planet today, and not even realizing when you pass thresholds, what happens to life. Again, only about 5% of the county where this pipeline went across was exposures of the Hell Creek. However, 90% will actually be digging into the Hell Creek of this through Harding County itself, and that is when they will find fossils. It's not like archaeological sites or historical sites where you see things on the surface. On the contrary, if it's grassed over, you're not going to see anything until you dig, and when you dig, you will find things. And we're very concerned that these fossils, which when they are found, there needs to be a mechanism where if it's something of importance, they should have a paleontologist on site at all times. While they're digging, they dig, I've been told, something at the rate of a mile to a mile and a half a day, so they're going to be going through a lot of land in a very fast order, and you're not going to see something until, in some cases, it's going to be too late. But still, you may be able to salvage a lot of these fossils that otherwise would be lost, and I think it's important, if this plan goes through, that these fossils are taken into consideration. The federal government has just recently this year passed the Paleontological Protection Act, which was part of the omnibus spending bill for the Department of Interior, and that makes it a felony on public land, on public federal land, for someone to destroy a fossil or even to collect a fossil without the proper permit papers. That shows how important the federal government thinks these fossils are. And it is always the Bureau of Land Management, for instance, when they cross their land, pipeline companies always have to have a paleontologist with them, and those paleontologists have the ability to shut this down. Now, the county also owns a lot of land, and there's a little bit of state land that's crossed in Harding County. It would be, I think, very advisable not just to have the paleontologists in Harding County, but through the other counties as well. As one of our speakers mentioned here from Tripp County, that there are fossils there as well. Now, it's not perhaps as critical of time period. It's we're looking more at something that's more like 10 million years old. But still, there could be something that's significant scientific value and significant economic value to the ranchers themselves, which will be lost if somebody's not watching out for it. So I guess my basic statement is that I'm very concerned about these fossils and what's going to happen when this pipeline goes through if nobody's watching over them.
Thanks very much, Mr. Larson. And I, Commissioner Kolbeck did bring up your comments today during our hearing and made reference to your letter and your comments at Buffalo. So, you know, certainly the commission is listening and even brought you up today. Commissioner Kolbeck, anything else to add?
That's just it. I just want to thank you for your letter. It actually prompted me to ask some questions, and it's good information to have, so I appreciate you sending that to us. We do, I don't think this is speaking out of school, but there were experts who talked on paleontology today, and we did discuss them. It is in the record, and I think that's probably all I can say about the docketed item. But
could you tell me who those experts were?
Mr. Smith, how does that apply to our case?
Let's go ahead and have Ms. Semler and Mr. Larson speak, and she can kind of brief you on what sort of witnesses lineup she's had today and plans to have tomorrow,
okay.
If that makes sense.
If you would like some more information from me at any time, I'll leave this with my telephone numbers and all that, too, so and email, and I'll leave that with, I guess, whoever I'm going to be talking to.
Where? Yeah, Ms. Semler right there.
And are any of those maps confidential, Mr. Larson?
I'm sorry?
Are any of those maps confidential?
I think I wouldn't publish them, no.
Okay, we can mark them as confidential if you
like. So they stay within the committee, and so you can see some of the density of some of these fossil sites. And this is all on a private ranch, and I'm sure that, you know, we don't want them put out for everybody to – everybody and their kids. There's three T-Rex sites, by the way, where the pipeline grows. There are three T-Rex sites which are within a quarter section of land, and it goes right through that. And that's it's a historic site as well as because these specimens have been collected. But this is a historic site where these specimens were located, and we and paleontologists need access to those sites to go back because we learn more and more about how to take data and how to, how to understand life of the past. And without access to those sites, or if these sites are destroyed, it's not a good thing.
Before you hand any papers over, if you don't want them, everything we get gets published on the web. If you don't want those published on the web, we need to have you write confidential at the top of every single page.
Okay, just the map is the only.
Okay, thing. Anything you give that can't go on the web and is confidential, go ahead and mark confidential on the top of that. Thanks very much.
Dusty, I do have a question.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry, Commissioner.
That's no problem. I very much appreciate your testimony or the information that you provided to us when we were in Buffalo, correct?
Yes.
And as you said earlier, and this evening as well. We had in part of the discussion that we had today, and we're going to have a little bit more, I believe, tomorrow on paleontology. And I'm curious what your thought would be pertaining to prioritization of fossils to an extent. We heard a little bit today that there may be somewhat of a prioritization invertebrates compared to vertebrates, recognizing that there's a host of cephalopods and trilobites seem to be fairly plentiful in that area from a standpoint of fossil fuels. Yes, T-Rex are pretty rare. What would you think of a prioritization to an extent of
the
fossils?
In terms of my research and my view of what the priorities would be, Harding County is probably one of the most sensitive spots in the nation. And actually, as they go through Montana, near Baker, Montana, they're going to have the same problems. And up near Fort Peck, Montana, and this pipeline is going to encounter things which are quite possibly very, very significant in our understanding of, again, global climate change, as well as just how much a population can change from just small amounts of change in our climate. And so that would be my priority, is Harding County, the most important. There are fossils throughout the line, and I think it would be advantageous to have a paleontologist there to try to salvage what they could as they're going through, and make things, you know, to watch it. But the almost the entire length of Harding County where the pipeline goes is through the Hell Creek Formation, and right at that KT boundary. It goes above the impact zone or above the extinction event, and it goes down back down into it again several times, and could be some really, really significant things that will show up while that's happening. And I
think
they need to be paid attention to.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Larson. Two comments. We are trying to work on the windows. We're not trying to sweat anybody out of the room. They have foolproofed the windows, and we've managed to get an expert here to help us out. So thanks very much. Secondly, and people have been pretty good about not reiterating public comment they made at other locations, but this was a good example about how we all took very, very strong mental notes and written notes about what Mr. Larson said in Buffalo, referred today to his letter, referred today to his testimony. So to a certain extent, you know, we want to avoid redundancy so we can be respectful of everybody's time tonight. So if you've already said it, you know, we've got it. It's in the official record. So that being said, we don't mind you coming up and giving us a brief, you know, reminder of what you told us. So. Welcome.
My name is Zona Vig, V as in Victor, I-G. My husband and I own a ranch in northern Meade County. We are members of Dakota Rural Action, and I'm the current executive board secretary. We are thankful that this organization has been so helpful to the landowners and the people of South Dakota. I would like to make note that there would be other ranchers here tonight, but the ones that we visited with and said, sorry, we can't come, and these were some of the things that are going on in our country. One was preg testing cows, another was weaning calves, some were hauling hay and digging water lines for a neighbor. So our numbers may not be as much as we would have liked to have been here this evening to visit with you, but they're thinking about you. And to perhaps explain, it's just as this is your full-time job, ranching is our full-time job, and it's very hard to work in extra meetings. Landowners along the Keystone XL pipeline are passionate about a foreign country having the ability to use our American laws against us. It's a hurtful thing. As a landowner, we did not ask for, nor did we want this invasion onto our precious resource. We are stewards of this land that has been in our family nearly 100 years. However, if this has to happen, we are adamant that all possible safeguards be in place. We have questions that haven't been answered factually, and we've visited with many people from TransCanada. And they, meaning TransCanada, can only say, and obviously we're talking with people who represent them, but certainly if they represent them, they should be able to answer our questions. They say things like, we don't know, we haven't had a question like that before, or we think so-and-so or thus-and-so. Think. We want to know about things like how the heat from the pipeline will affect the top of the ground, how it will affect deep-rooted crops like alfalfa. Because when we asked about crops, all we got was, well, it will grow better. And they were talking about corn and wheat and such. And then when we asked about alfalfa, it was like, oh, we've never thought of that one. How are we liable if our ranching equipment drops through and hits the pipe? How far the crude oil will spew from a break? How much oil will be leaked from a small break that can't be detected from a pressure drop? I spent a couple of days in the last couple of weeks visiting with county officials and landowners in North Dakota. We went on a tour, and we visited with people from a county that would be equal to our county highway superintendent, their specialist on weeds, fire, police, and and police sheriff, and also their if they had a catastrophic incident in their county. And the recurring theme was that TransCanada said one thing at the beginning, but in actuality, payment for damages had to be fought for, and then they had to settle for less. And this is county officials. This is not just landowners, because we did visit with landowners, but this is county officials, and they were very strong about it. They visited very forthrightly with us, and they said, you be careful. Things started out wonderful, and by the end, he said, I wanted to bury the guy. I mean, that's how hard it got to be. And I don't think that's what we want. I think we want it up front. And he mentioned several things that he said, I wish we would have done. And one of them was big bonds. He said, we had one, but he says, it scares me. It wasn't big enough. So the line that they heard, and as I, and when I say line, the sentence that they heard and we've heard many times is, your roads will be as good or better than when we came. Now, I've personally heard that many times, and they said it up there, and they said, and according to this North Dakota official, he says that's very close to a lie. He didn't say it. He said it's very close to a lie, because that's not what happened. And he gave me specifics. We stood there and visited after the meeting quite a while, and he talked about how they said this, but when it came time, they even said, are you sure we even drove on that road? And if he hadn't taken pictures and had people sign things that they saw them, they would have dismissed it entirely. So, please, don't be gullible. And just because they say one thing, please don't accept it without facts and in writing. Because that's what he said. I wish I had got more in writing. Please stand up for South Dakota and don't let possible dollar signs blind you. We implore you to have an independent on-site construction inspector paid for by TransCanada to ensure construction follows rules, and if TransCanada does not, to have the power to shut them down. And I've been hearing different things. And we ran into them saying, oh, you don't have somebody you can call, and we did meet a liaison, but that's a TransCanada person. I'm talking about somebody who doesn't have anything to gain from them. That's what I'm asking for. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Vig.
Thank you, Ms. Vig, for your comments and your questions. I certainly think this process, and I think the commissioners would agree with me, will address most of those concerns, whether it be her concerns with regards to weeds or fire or police or leak detection. I mean, this is these are all issues that are addressed by the application, and certainly over the last 2 days we've had some discussion with regards to this.
Okay. We're going to pause for just a minute to see, and all the comments have been great. I mean, I don't dispute any of them. We've gotten three folks in the last 35 minutes, which I think is fine. We want people to say what they want to say. Let's just pause to see if anybody's got a relatively quick comment or a relatively quick question, something along the, 1 or 2 minutes of comment. We'll take them first, and then we'll get back to the longer conversations we've been having. Yeah, go ahead. And since we've already given you one shot, this will be real short. Go ahead. Great.
Name's John Harter, H-A-R-T-E-R, Winter, South Dakota. One of the first things I want to address is on Keystone 1, I read a state geology report that recommended that the line be moved 8 miles east of where it's presently at. And I can't tell you what county, but 8 miles east into heavier till soil to protect the chance of a spill from reaching the groundwater. And
This was this line was approved to run as it was put into or backed by TransCanada. So it was not moved to protect the groundwater. And I think this is kind of disturbing, I think. So I would like that to be in record and that this be looked at because it's an important issue. Okay. To TransCanada, I worked for several years with in a mechanic shop, and we bent exhaust pipe for vehicles. I would like to know how you bend this heavy steel pipe without changing the strength factor of the pipe.
Do you have other questions, Mr. Harder?
Yes.
Okay, let's run through them real quick because we're giving you a second chance here, which I'm happy to do, but let's get your questions, and then we can get them answered.
Sure. Where the saddles were used on the pipeline, my understanding, floated back up out of the ground. I think this needs to be looked at because the when something floats back up out of the ground when it's been covered with quite a bit of dirt, it's got to have stress in some area. So maybe this pipeline should have been replaced instead of just saddled and reburied. Okay, and then the second question along that same agenda is when they put these saddles on, is it by law required that it's supposed to have a heavier pipeline where these are in place? Okay, and then a neighbor, or he's actually my banker, but his son works with pipeline from a company. And it was he told me that it was stated that the larger diameter of the line, the more of the chance of a problem with the line. So my question is, we went from a 30-inch line to a 36-inch line, so maybe this changes the safety factor. Maybe we should go back to a 30-inch line to be more safe. Okay? Another issue that this kind of relates back to the comment that I made earlier that may have offended some people, and I apologize if it did, but I was told, and I don't know if it happened in Tripp County, that TransCanada took some of our local governing bodies out and wined and dined them. I think this compromises the whole effect of this whole procedure. Okay, so just so you know where some of my statements could have come from. Okay. Then I was also told by a very reliable source that Keystone 1 was welding the pipeline when it was raining. I would like this issue addressed to know, is this a standard procedure and is it a safe procedure? Okay, I think that's all.
Those are great questions, Mr. Harder. I want to make sure we get thorough answers to all of them. So I'm going to not give TransCanada an opportunity to respond right now, but again, being cognizant of the hour, I'm going to hear from anybody who wants to get on the road first. At some point, we'll come back. We'll make sure you get your answers.
Okay. Thank you very much.
No, you bet. Thanks for the questions. Very good ones. All right, we'll pause again just to see if anybody's got relatively brief comments. Welcome, Commissioner.
Thank you. Let's just switch on at least. Either one. Is this on? I'm Robert Johnson from Buffalo, South Dakota, Harding County, where this pipeline is going to run about 73 miles through, about a fourth of it. And I do believe that the issues as far as reseeding and taking care of the land and the issues of compensation need to be addressed. And I think they will be, and I hope that they will be. But I also think that, you know, we're hearing a lot of negative comments, and some of them are due. They needed to be made. But there's also some good things that are going to happen with this pipeline. I know taxes are something that you don't deal with. I am a commissioner in Harding County, although these comments are strictly mine. It is going to be a benefit to a lot of these counties and to the taxpayers in those counties. I know in Harding County they talked that it could cut our taxes in half. Now, I don't know whether that's right or wrong.
if it cuts them in by a quarter. It's quite a benefit, and it will help everybody. And we're in the process of trying to build a new school in Harding County, and it's going to be a burden for our taxpayers. But if this thing comes through and it will work like everybody says it will, or even close to what they say, it's going to help us build that school. It's going to help us have probably one of the best schools in the area. And I think that's important. And I think that that is an issue in this thing, too, is that there is some good points to this pipeline that will help everything. You know, as far as the oil and coming out of a foreign country, I think we use a lot of oil out of foreign countries. And I think maybe Canada could be just as good a partner as some of the others. Anyway, that's my comments. And I do think that they should. Now, on the paleontology, a thing that bothers me is if we start getting so tough on our paleontology, and we need to be concerned with it, but I don't want to have to put a water pipeline in that goes in 6 feet deep and have to hire paleontologists to follow me along to put a pipeline in my property. So I think we've got to be a little bit careful where we go with some of these things, that we don't set standards that maybe all of us can't deal with. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Johnson. Other comments approximately that length? Come on down.
Good evening. My name is Pete Bardison, B as in boy, A-R-D as in dog, E-S-O-N. Excuse me. And I'm the business manager for the Laborers Union for the state of South Dakota. I live in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. I've been involved with the Trans-Canada Keystone Pipeline for the last year and a half, and I've recruited laborers. I've sent them to our pipeline training and safety programs and sent them out to work on these pipeline, on the existing pipeline. This year, the pipeline employed approximately 100 South Dakotans, which is just one of the crafts that helped construct the pipeline. The construction of the Trans-Canada XL pipeline will over double that amount of labor jobs for South Dakotans at a time when the economy is on a downswing. And these are good-paying jobs with health insurance, prescription card, dental and optical insurance. Each of these spreads roughly will have 500 to 600 people from every aspect of the project that will be living in this state for the duration of the project. This is good for all the local economies because of they will be renting hotels, houses, apartments. The contractors will be renting, you know, property for their yards, warehousing. People will be, you know, buying food, eating in the restaurants, clothing, everything that us South Dakotans purchase in our state to live, these people will be doing the same. I would like to read, I brought in hundreds of testimonies. I brought in three small quick ones to kind of touch three areas. Now, this is from an individual. My name is Jason Silvernail. I live in Yankton, South Dakota, where I have resided all my life. I am a family man. I was unemployed December 15th of 2008 through May 20th, 2009, due to the downturn in the economy. I found out about the pipeline coming through South Dakota, so I called Laborers Local 620 in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, for a job. I became a union member in March of 2009. I went to Omaha, Nebraska, and took the pipeline classes, which that's where our training fund is. It is actually a small scale of a pipeline with the right-of-way, and we train every aspect and what a job responsibility the labor has on the pipeline, along with terminology. It's 90% on-hands work and 10% classroom work. So we get our men and women prepared and familiarized with what the responsibilities are so they are knowledgeable when they go up on these lines to perform this work. Okay, he started work. He worked with Price Gregory, which started in southern part of South Dakota around the Yankton area on May 20th. It was one of the best moves I've ever taken. This job has helped me save our home and transportation. The benefits are outstanding, especially when we were paying high COBRA insurance. All right, here's another one. This is from a small business owner, South Dakota. My name is Bruce Pearson. I have lived in South Dakota all my life and the Sioux Falls area since 1996. I have been a small business owner for the past 8 years and managed well. My concrete business supported me and my family. We have 4 children, ages 6, 4, and twins, age 2. We have purchased a home in Crooks and lived well on my salary. This year, however, I couldn't find work. I was out looking, talking to people day after day, but there was no work. When Michaels hired me to work on the pipeline, I was desperate. We struggled to make our house payment and pay $1,200 monthly for health insurance because my twins have health problems. I was afraid we were going to lose our home and all of our equity. And where do you put 4 kids, my wife and I? I feel the pipeline saved us. They pay good money and provide insurance. There were 600 people working on the crews. All of them lived in small communities in South Dakota, bought groceries, clothing, gasoline for their vehicles. They had to make an impact on those communities. I have talked to other businessmen, and it doesn't look like my business is going to recover for the next few years. And I need a job to be a productive father in South Dakotan. I hope South Dakotans will support the pipeline construction. I have one more. This is from a manager of small business. We the people on the eastern part of the state have been reading and listening to the people trying to stop TransCanada from putting the pipeline through the western part of our state. May I take a few moments of your time and have my say in this matter? We've had manufacturing close and major layoffs in the past 2 years. I manage a subway on I-90 exit 353 at Spencer, South Dakota. It's a gas station subway in the middle of nowhere surrounded by nothing but farmland. We have a truck fueling and gas store. We have a small convenience store with a subway in it. We are in the middle of 4 small towns. The layoffs have hurt our business. We noticed the vacationers were also down this year. In July, TransCanada pipeline workers started to arrive. Our small town of Spencer had 150 residents until the apartments and campers started filling our village. We probably have 225 people. Now the workers use our bank's post office, small gas station in Spencer. Our subway sales have soared. We have increased sales from last year about 35% to 40% because of the pipeline. The town from Mitchell all the way to Sioux Falls have pipeline workers in their towns. All the empty apartments, farmhouses, and campgrounds have been full of the workers. If your small towns west hurt by the economy, you need to think about how the money the workers spend while in our state can help their towns. My employees and myself have and still enjoy waiting on the workers. My subway hit highest sales records with the pipeline employees here. Reality will hit our area when the pipeline work leaves us. We have friends for life with some of these workers. Thank you for taking a moment of your time. Feel free to call me at work for more information if need be. Thank you, Sue Moorhead. And there's two emails for states. Congratulations on highest sales week ever. Nice job. Second week in a row, tell the pipeliners thank you. This comes from the Vice President of Port Petroleum Company Products.
Mr. Bartison, did you have a lot more?
No, I'm wrapping up right now. The TransCanada pipeline will be a win-win situation for landowners, business owners, and South Dakota workers. Thank you for your time.
Good to see you again, Mr. Bartison. Thanks.
Steve, Dusty.
Yeah.
Steve, Gary.
Thank you. Other comments? We'll do one last call for people with shorter comments. Okay, go ahead, Mr. Doolittle.
Thank you. Is this on?
Sounds like it, I think.
My name is Jim Doolittle, D-O-O-L-I-T-T-L-E. And my family and I own and operate a ranch in Harding County, right east of Buffalo. We own property that the proposed pipeline may cross, that probably 3 or 4 miles potentially. And 1.5 years ago, we gave permission to TransCanada to do some of the preliminary survey work. And so far at this point, we haven't had any problems with any of the land people that we've had contact with. They've been polite, and they've been easy to work with, and really haven't had any problems. I'm glad I came here tonight because I think I've heard a lot of things I hadn't heard before as far as concerns, and I think they're legitimate. I trust that you will ensure that the safety and environmental concerns that have been brought out this evening will be resolved. But at this point in time, my family and I have been and currently are in favor of the project for a couple of reasons. One is, of course, we believe that it serves a national interest in the sense that the project or projects like this may lessen dependence on foreign oil, particularly Middle Eastern. Second issue that I think has been brought out earlier too is that it will have a major economic impact in South Dakota during not only the construction phase, but the long-term tax revenue that will be utilized to support local schools, counties, and other local governments. So we think that's major. I have a couple support letters that I'll leave with you that essentially support the project in the same manner that I've briefly indicated. One is from Black Hills Community Economic Development, of which I serve as the executive for, and some of the same reasons I just mentioned. And by the way, I live in Belle Fourche most of the time. The other is from Black Hills Council of Local Governments, which is the regional planning and community development organization that covers the counties of Bennett, Butte, Custer, Harding, Lawrence, Meade, Pennington, and Fall River. And their board went on record at their last meeting, and their board consists of county officials or county commissioners or city council people from those counties I mentioned, went on record in supporting the project as well. So I'll leave those with you, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Doolittle. Other short comments? Thanks.
Good evening. My name is Susan Lyman, L-Y-M-A-N, and I live in the Ogeton-Murdo area. My family's involved in both ranching as well as in the hotel-motel business in the Murdo area. And my comment is in regards to the man previous to this last gentleman, and he had commented that the economic impact in the small communities with the TransCanada employees living in the communities. I recently read an environment impact study that stated that would not be the case, that these workers would indeed be living in work camps. They were hoping to put 600 people in the winter area, as well as there was also going to be a work camp in another area of the state. And I was wondering if anyone could answer if that is indeed going to be the way it is.
Great question. Do you have other questions?
No.
Okay. Mr. Jones?
Do you want me to answer that? No. Sure. I can. The plan right now is to use work camps.
However, we have used them in the past in different regions, and there still is tremendous economic benefits to the community. People do come and go. The work camps are mainly focused right now for the main pipeline spread, but there are seven unique pump stations that need to be constructed in the state, and those workers are not right now scheduled to use the work camps and will continue to use, like, hotels or they may use the local motels or camping situations, whatever they may choose to do. But the same kind of economic benefit may be somewhat diminished because they're in work camps, but this also helps balance the fact that there just isn't enough hotels and there just isn't enough restaurants in some of these remote regions.
Thank you.
Mr. Jones, do your workers on the existing pipeline, they can't just live anywhere along the pipeline while they're here?
So on the first project, that's pretty much the description. They were living literally everywhere. I think farmhouses and motels and hotels and such. And there are a lot of communities that tell you that the no vacancy sign was up pretty much regularly when the pipeline was going through those communities. Really the arrangements with our prime contractor, and he makes the arrangements with his workers, and sometimes they have labor arrangements with the various unions as well, as described earlier. But there is options, and you know what, we still don't know all the full details of those options, and so that's still an outstanding question.
All right, thank you. Go ahead, sir.
My name is John Iverson, Iverson. The other fellow, I don't know what his name was, just testified about their being dependency on foreign oil. I think that's a good thing. But what guarantees do we have after this line's all in and this oil's refined down in Texas? We have no guarantees it's not going to be exported to Japan or China. Canada going to put something in writing that it will stay in the United States or Canada? We go through all this headache for maybe nothing. Do they have a response for that?
I could probably spend the rest of the night talking about this. I have a lot of passion. The U.S. right
I'll just
now,
interrupt by saying I have seen Mr. Jones get heated up a couple of times about the discussion about global demand for petroleum products, and he is quite knowledgeable. But
well,
Mr. Jones, maybe
I guess all I want to know is if it's staying in the United States or not. That's my question.
Sure. Perhaps we get 30-second
yes
version of Mr.
No.
Jones. And yeah.
Absolutely. The fundamental principle is that the U.S. imports between 7 and 9 million barrels every single day, and it just seems reasonable when you think about the fact that we consume about 17 to 20 million barrels every day, that principle will remain the same. And so what's going to happen over the next 20 to 40 years is that the rest of the world is consumption is going to grow rapidly. China, Russia, India, and so the competition for oil is going to continue to grow. And so I don't see a situation where the refineries in the Gulf Coast would export the refined product when they consume and they import so many, many millions of barrels. So experts, independent of TransCanada, have already shown the long-term forecasters for continued dependence on foreign sources, and it just is logical to put the second largest crude oil proven reserves in Canada and marry them up with the largest refining complex in the world in the Gulf Coast. And so when you think of that natural hedge, that natural marriage, I cannot see or foresee an opportunity where it would make sense to then turn on and export that to a different country.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Iverson. All right, well, we give him the short talkers some opportunity. Go ahead.
My name is Tom Wilson, Wilson, from Buffalo, South Dakota. I'm a rancher that the pipeline does not cross my land. It does not. I am here because of the what I feel could be an economic stimulus to the economy of Harding County. Here we got a government that's trying to give economic stimulus to the people, and we're looking at ways to shut one down. This could help tremendously if TransCanada, which they have said they will use, as much local contractors, which will help limit the damage to local infrastructure, such as your roads. If they use such things as fencing crews, utilize the local weed board, which would utilize your local sprayers. You have knowledge right there that would help eliminate a lot of problems. The seeding with your local conservation district. The impact could be tremendous if they utilize the gravel trucks, blades, your independent fire department trucks, and independent EMTs. That would eliminate a tremendous amount of pressure on the local infrastructure. TransCanada, I contacted them about assisting with a local project up there that supports, it's a local youth protection program, and they were very helpful. They donated quite financially, enough to actually pay for everything we did in 1 year, and they basically said that they would look at it again next year. I have, and I'm not going to read them all. I will give these to you for your use. 31 signed letters of support for the pipeline. 16 verbal. These people could not get their, we had given these out and did not get the mail back to us, but they said they would sign them. And then there are two letters of support that I will mail down to you or fax them, that the gentleman was coming and he was going to come down and testify, and he had to go into Wyoming on a land deal. And he is a local rancher also and local contractor. Okay?
Thanks very much, Mr. Wilson, and a good reminder that this is not anyone's last opportunity to be heard. Certainly the commission is still happy to take any comments that you might have in writing. In some respects, written comments can be of more value. We do have a transcript here, but sometimes it'll take a couple of weeks before the transcript is polished, ready to go, and up on the web. So, Commissioner Colbeck, did you have something?
No, that was exactly what I was going to remind you to mention. You hit the nail on the head. The door is always open. We can't discuss specifics of the case, but we can continue to take your comments, concerns. We want to hear them. So that was a perfect example of the guy couldn't make it in. We'll always take those.
Well, and in fact, I don't think there's a single month, maybe not even a week, but I don't think there's a month that's gone by that I haven't talked about or dealt with the TransCanada One pipeline, some aspect of it. So even, you know, if a permit were to be granted, we're certainly not done by any stretch of the imagination. If that were to happen, not saying it's going to. Other comments? Any comments? Yeah, Ms. Trask, welcome.
Stephanie Trask, staff for Dakota Rural Action, and I'm reading these comments on behalf of Mike and Sue Simpson, landowners from Howard, South Dakota, along the Keystone One pipeline. Greetings, South Dakota Public Utilities commissioners and staff. Due to the late soybean harvest, we are unable to attend tonight's comment period. We want to thank Dakota Rural Action for agreeing to read the following testimony. This is our story of some of the construction process, PUC conditions not being followed, and the construction agreement with TransCanada that was breached many times. We want the commissioners to understand that what we have to say all has documentation to prove that what we went through is the truth. June 23, 2009, Michael's construction workers and vehicles knowingly trespassed on our property. They drove across a vacated, unimproved section line to put up goal posts for transmission power lines. The workers left garbage, and when leaving our property, failed to properly close a gate. We did not press charges against them, even though they lied about the incident. We gave the company a free pass. August 24 through the 26th, 2009, the pipe bending crew. They had no respect for our property. They left their garbage all over our property at the end of the day. In our construction agreement, we asked to have all our garbage removed. It was not followed. The crew was busy writing messages to each other on the pipe. Maybe that is why they left the garbage. We still would like to know who Jim and Sally are. We had to make phone calls to the construction company and Sarah Metcalf before the garbage was finally taken care of. June through October 2009, as we live close to the township road, we requested reduced speed signs and dust control. Many construction vehicles did not follow the reduced speed signs. We do have documentation of the speeding trucks. We also witnessed loaded fuel trucks failing to follow the law about stopping at stop signs, even in fog. September 3, 2009, PUC Condition 34. We feel that this condition was not followed on our property. After an overnight rain of 1.3 inches, construction continued. This was probably the worst day of our lives. There were many construction vehicles slugging mud to dig the trench. It was not a pretty sight. Water was pumped off the easement area to our property. The construction company did not follow the construction agreement again. We did not give permission to dewater. The wetland areas on our property were a big mess. September 2009, PUC Condition 15. We were told that to complete and sign a construction agreement would help protect us as landowners. We did sign the agreement July 9, 2009. And as a subset, our copy says water pumping may be allowed, but must get with Mike Simpson before pumping. No one contacted Mike to get permission to pump the water. The construction company went ahead and did what they wanted. Another breach of the agreement. September 2009, PUC Condition 18. Rock excavation from the trench may be used to backfill the trench only to the top of the existing bedrock profile. All other rock shall be considered construction debris. Construction Agreement 13, rock removal. We requested that we did not want rock removal, that we did want rock removal, and we wanted the rocks hauled off. Once again, our request was not even considered. The huge rock pile was buried on our property. Some single rocks in the easement area were pushed into the clay and covered with topsoil. This condition states that all rock is to be considered construction debris. Why were the rocks not hauled away? We just wanted you to know that the permit conditions that you granted to TransCanada Keystone Project were not followed. Commissioners, maybe now you know how the landowners feel when conditions, requests, and rights are totally ignored. In closing, we want to thank Lillian Anderson, Kent Mweckley, and Kurt Hone for all the help they gave us these past 3 years. We need to elect more people like them to public office. Thank you for your time. Respectfully submitted, Mike and Sue Simpson. And they've also enclosed a copy of the construction conditions agreement and pictures of the construction conditions agreement violations.
Do you know, Ms. Trask, tough situation to put you in because you're not the Simpsons, obviously. Do you know to what extent they mentioned Sarah Metcalf once? They never mentioned PUC staff. Do you know to what extent they contacted commission staff with their concerns?
I think you'll have to get in touch with the SIPs.
Okay. I count seven or eight, you know, alleged violations of the commission's order. Ms. Semler, were you contacted by the Simpsons with that kind of frequency?
No. We do have a complaint process here at the PUC, an informal complaint process where Deb, Greg, and I work closely with company representation to try to understand the problem and solve things informally. And if we can't find a sufficient solution, either by our standards or by the landowner standards, we have a formal complaint process. And no one has used that process from the first pipeline.
Okay. And I don't want to minimize what Mike and Sue, their comments, because they're very earnest people. They're very sincere people. I know them. I know they've got concerns. I just want to reiterate that for those of you that are along the existing pipeline route, the Keystone East, that if you do have concerns, Ms. Semler, Ms. Gregg, other members of the team, I think are willing to try to resolve those concerns. Okay, thanks, Ms. Trask.
That just brings up a good point that if we do start a complaint process, you need to be willing to sign your name to the facts, which is not a big deal. But without that, then we can't start our process. So, it's very informal. We'll help you as much as we can. But if you do have trouble, please contact the people that we have working on it, sign a complaint, and then we can drive the bus from there. But we got to take that initial step.
Next up. Okay, go ahead.
Is that on?
Yeah.
Good. My name is Peter Carrolls. I work for the Sierra Club. I live in Aberdeen. And
spelling of your last name, Mr. Carrolls?
Oh, I'm sorry. C-A-R-R-E-L-S. It's commonly misspelled. I should do that.
Well, that's why I asked. There were five that immediately sprung to my mind as for a spelling, so go ahead.
So much of this proceeding has focused on landowner concerns, and I think that that's vitally important and very appropriate. But I wanted to comment on the a big picture perspective related to this pipeline, and it relates to the conversation that you had about the global uses of petroleum that you were commenting on earlier. I hadn't even intended to comment here, but after hearing that, I had to jot a few things down and I think give a flip side to that the point that the fellow from TransCanada has made. We can't forget that this pipeline has a beginning. It begins in the tar sands area of Alberta, and it's going to have an endpoint, whether it's refineries or shipping locations. We know that tar sands crude is probably the dirtiest crude oil on this continent. Tar sands crude requires more energy-intensive and emissions-heavy processing than any other oil. We can't know how the current debate over climate change legislation will shake out, but it seems certain that it's going to address carbon emission problems. It's already doing that in some ways with different regulations from various agencies. Tar sands refiners will most certainly be affected by these regulations. I was looking at an article the other day, and it contains a quote by a fellow named Peter Whitman, who's a policy analyst with the U.S. Department of Energy. He told an industry conference in Houston on October 28th, because oil sands requires more energy-intensive emissions-heavy processing, the cost of producing gasoline and diesel from the Alberta crude will climb more steeply than it would for refining light grades of oil. He went on to say the refining emissions costs could represent a significant portion of current refining margins and would disadvantage the domestic refiners versus the importer who does not have to pay for emissions at the refining level. We have to wonder about the future of tar sands mining and tar sands refining. I trust that a company like TransCanada has assembled a business plan that accounts for these many contingencies. But it also seems clear that the future marketplace for tar sands crude oil is going to be very volatile. If U.S. refineries can't refine tar sands crude because of legislation-mandated costs related to carbon regulations, where will the tar sands be sent for refining? Also, many analysts, and this contradicts what you also said, believe that U.S. gasoline consumption has now peaked. If true, where will the tar sands that are going to be piped beneath South Dakota soil be refined and used? And I think South Dakotans need to know the destination, domestic or otherwise, for tar sands oil. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Mr. Carrolls. And Mr. Jones, I'm sure you've got comments, but I'm going to skip past them because I do want to be cognizant of the hour, and I know we got other people who want to speak. So take some notes, and at the end of this, if you want to make some comments, we'd be happy to hear them. Yeah, Mr. Lawrence, welcome.
Hi. Green button on. Craig Lawrence from Sioux Falls, L-A-W-R-E-N-C-E. I know that you know a lot about this project, and this is a hard meeting, isn't it? A pressing national need. XL and Keystone together would replace almost 30% of what we import from OPEC. A good economic benefit to our state, tens of millions in property taxes from a company that will become our largest property taxpayer over decades. against landowners, very sincere, who will be disrupted, no doubt, and who are very sincere about their concern for the land. Tough call. I just bring you a perspective tonight based on what my experience has been. If I were in your shoes, what I'd be asking myself all the time would be, if based on what we've experienced in Keystone, is this something we want to put our people through again? I'd be asking, did they keep their word? Did they respect our landowners? Did they listen to complaints and respond? In short, should we just willingly let them carve another trench through our ranch and farmlands, knowing that some will disapprove, there will be some who are angry that we cross their lands by force of law, some who will be inconvenienced for a time by damaged roads and disrupted lands? I believe I bring a unique perspective on these questions because last year Robert Jones hired our firm to document the construction of Keystone in video form to get on tape what really happens up and down the line to get out there and report. I suppose some might say that in being so hired, I'm no longer objective, but if you'll look me straight in the eye, I want to talk to you as a 34-year South Dakota businessman who employs 200 people and cares deeply about our economic, our social, and our environmental future. During the construction of the Keystone, we've been all the way from the oil sands at Fort McKierney to the terminal at Hardisty, then across Canada and down through all the states, ultimately to the Wood River Station at Wood River, Illinois, where the pipeline terminates there at the refineries. And we've talked to dozens and dozens of landowners, mayors, county commissioners, pipeline workers, chambers of commerce, restaurant operators, and many more of the faces and communities touched by Keystone. We would summarize our experience by telling you three things that we've observed about TransCanada as they near completion of the Keystone project. First, I find in them a genuine concern about listening and responding to the wishes of landowners. We can all imagine how difficult it is for a farmer to watch a pipeline trencher rip through his most productive fields and wonder if it's ever going to be put back the way it was. But we've watched TransCanada time and again go the distance in working with landowners to create satisfaction. I've seen leaders from TransCanada travel hundreds of miles to work out a single complaint and to try to make things right. One of the first areas completed was in North Dakota. There, among others, we talked with Walhalla farmer Jim Metalman, who said, on the basis of his experience, they're good to work with. Quote, what they say, they do. North Dakota State Senator Kurt Olufsen, who serves in their legislature, looked out over the lands reclaimed and across the scenic Pembina Gorge and said, this has been a great project for North Dakota. To be candid, there were sinkholes caused by the pipeline that only became evident last winter, but they were repaired early this spring to the senator's satisfaction. Last week, I traveled through Marshall and Beadle counties, where record rainfall has made things very difficult, and if patience is short there, it's no wonder, because the farmers are waiting and waiting to harvest one of the best crops in memory. And I don't know if you've been there, but it's just a moisture mess. It's unbelievable. I couldn't believe that TransCanada could actually put a pipeline in under those conditions, and I was almost astounded to see how well they can get the land back in nearly its original condition when it's so wet. But I looked at the details of the work as well. I noted how the edges of the dirt were carefully blended with the undisturbed fields, as though the person doing it really cared about what they were doing. I saw roads repaired effectively with a base of crushed red granite. Next to the Carpenter pumping station, an area just pounded by trucks, the road was back in shape. I was elected supervisor of my township for 20 years in Lincoln County, and I've overseen repair of a lot of moisture-damaged gravel roads. TransCanada is getting them back in shape. Admittedly, some are still pretty bad, but I'm confident they'll be fixed right. Further down the line at Condee, South Dakota farmer Lynn Sanderson summed up his experience with Keystone, quote, everything that's been promised has happened. At Yankton, the Chamber of Commerce rolled out the red carpet for TransCanada in a community-wide barbecue tribute. Signs all over town thanked pipeline workers. The pipeline went through the city's east side, through one of their beautiful city parks, and then under the Missouri River. TransCanada did the work with diplomacy and skill, and by the way, Yankton's sales tax for 2009 is up, while most other cities in the states are down. The Yankton Chamber of Commerce says it's due to the Keystone Pipeline. Charles Kemper, 20-year mayor of Troy, Illinois, agrees. He told us the pipeline was just the boost they needed, and he didn't fail to note that the pipeline's path would take it right through their city's 18-hole pride and joy. So TransCanada did it right and bored quietly, unobtrusively under the golf course. We laughed while a tournament was in progress. But while building the pipeline with extreme sensitivity to landowners and communities along the way, TransCanada has also respected the environment. If you fly the pipeline's path, as some of you have, you'll see jogs everywhere for this wet land and that. You'll find horizontal bores under rivers and streams and lakes accomplished with an attention to detail that's surprising. We've been to the Carlisle Lake Wildlife Preserve near St. Louis. You wouldn't expect wildlife biologists and preserve managers to be very complimentary of a pipeline built through their prime waterfowl habitat. But TransCanada did it to their satisfaction, despite almost unbelievably wet conditions, completed precisely on time, right before the duck season opened. Lastly, TransCanada has built Keystone with a steadfast, almost over-the-top commitment to safety, to the safety of everyone who works on it or who is impacted by the pipeline. Giant projects like the Hoover Dam or the Interstate Highway System are infamous for the amount of lives they've claimed, but the Keystone Pipeline record is a tribute to a steadfast safety program. A month ago, I was north of St. Louis with the president of TransCanada, with its chief operating officer, its chairman of the board, and with Robert Jones. We were going out to inspect the line and check progress at the end at Wood River. Before we got anywhere, and you'll remember this, Gary, from our experience last fall, before we went out, even the president of TransCanada went through safety training and wore the required safety gear. At TransCanada, nobody sets safety or procedure aside, and that kind of attention to detail does overlap into careful land reclamation, into extreme regard for the environment, and a commitment to doing it right that makes me think, I believe they have genuinely endeavored to keep their word, that they have acted responsibly. I know there will be hardships with XL, but I still believe XL will be good for America and good for South Dakota. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lawrence. Other comments? Welcome.
Good evening. My name is Holly, H-O-L-L-Y, last name Waddell, W-A-D-D.
Ms. Waddell, I wonder if that mic's on.
Now it's off? Now it's on?
There you go. Okay, maybe just pull it a little closer to your mouth. That'd be great. Thanks. Sorry for the interruption.
Maybe we'll do this. Thank you for taking comments this evening. As I said, I'm Holly Waddell. I've been a member of Dakota Rural Action for about 11 years, and I currently serve as the chairman of the board. I'm third generation ranching on land homesteaded by my paternal grandmother. So stewardship of land and resources is paramount to my ability to stay on the land that I love. Dakota Rural Action is a grassroots family agriculture and conservation group that works to organize South Dakotans to preserve our family farmers, ranchers, natural resources, and our unique way of life. We have about 650 members all across the state. 40 of those members are directly impacted by nearly 100 miles of the TransCanada pipeline. my local chapter of DRA invited folks in our chapter area to an informational meeting on July 22nd of 2008. I helped put that meeting together, and we had about 75 people in attendance that night to learn about the pipeline proposed to cross our part of South Dakota. I maybe didn't mention where I'm from. I'm from Perkins County, which is up in the northwest corner, right next door to Harding. Dakota Rural Action has standing policy supporting only oil and gas pipeline development that is built to the highest standards for safety and environmental protection and which does not conflict with private property rights and good land stewardship. In addition to the comments you've heard thus far tonight, I would also want the commission to address the following concerns. We have requested, and I again ask you tonight, to release a detailed list of the names of the landowners who are facing the arrival of the pipeline on their property, including a detailed map of the route. In regards to the historical sites, those types of issues on our lands, you've already heard that some of the landowners have expended $20,000 of their out of their own pocket to have the sites documented, and this has kind of been a big economic drain for those on the land. And so we're wondering, do you as our public servants intend to permit this pipeline without an official environmental impact statement? Mr. Jones alluded to the filing of an emergency response plan. Where is that response plan? What will TransCanada's response time be? I live about 18 miles from the now famous McFarthest spot, a place on the map deemed to be the farthest distance from a McDonald's. I figure the nearest emergency response team is likely at least as far away as my McDonald's, if not further. And then what about educating our citizens who live near this pipeline, thinking about, you know, they've already said they don't expect our fire departments to respond, but there are some things that our local folks should know, such as, you know, maybe allowing for some safety drills so that if a fracture should occur, the folks on the land will know kind of the first things they should do. And also they should make sure that all of those who are in immediate proximity to the pipelines have those emergency numbers to call, like to the nearest pump station, so they can be alerted to shut the flow off. Those kinds of things. I think you need to build that into the expectations and the accountability. A condition of the permit should be the establishment of a bond for cleanup after spills and after abandonment. The socioeconomic impact statement already submitted to this commission, prepared by expert witness Madden, failed to address the pipeline's impact on land valuations, saleability, and insurability. We find this inadequate and imprudent on your part. We feel it is your responsibility to take these impacts into consideration as you consider the permit. We would like this commission to do a study on the worst case scenario. That's kind of something my husband and I, as we think about business decisions for our ranch, what's the worst thing that can happen? We'd like you to think about the worst case scenario should the pipeline fracture. this information is important for our counties to have on hand. This would be like distance of spray, volume, pressure, because as our counties look to cite or grant sightings in the county for roads or building permits, parks, any public use, that type of information we feel should be on record for all of the counties that have the pipeline going through them so they can make informed decisions. So in closing, in accordance with the Dakota Rural Actions policy, we are depending on you to approach this with due diligence and protecting the folks on our side of the state as well. And thank you for your time.
Excellent comments, Ms. Bedell. Thanks very much. Very specific and solution-oriented. Thanks.
Thank you.
Other comments? Good evening, sir.
My name is Hugh Ingalls. That's I-N-G-A-L-L-S. I'm from Faith. I don't have any prepared statement, and my comments will be categorized as short. Appreciate the opportunity we've had this evening of visiting with you. My concern is property rights. I feel that we need to be protected. I think we need to be justly compensated. I doubt whether my friends and relatives in urban areas would agree to selling a piece of the back lawn for an undetermined time. The last time I looked up perpetual in the dictionary, if I remember right, it was a long time. If we're talking about a 30-year, 40-year, 20-year pipeline, that's all along the easement needs to be. You'll probably get, TransCanada will probably get to exercise the due process in eminent domain. I probably won't be the only one because I will not sign a perpetual easement. I think that's really out of line. And I have one more question, just a question now, and I don't know who can answer it. But we're selling a narrow strip of land, as I understand it. We're given a perpetual easement on it. When it's all said and done, who owns the land? Who owns the 50-foot strip of land?
You've asked a specific question. Let's get you a specific answer. Anybody from the applicant wish to respond? Who owns the land?
Certainly, of course, we're talking about the definition of permanent easement. The easement only gives the pipeline company rights to the subsurface. The landowner owns the land. An easement isn't a change in ownership of land.
I guess my concern is, down the road, one pipeline wears out, how many more are they going to put in on that easement on my land? Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate your time.
Thanks, Mr. Engels. Good question. Other comments? We'll probably try to get a couple more in before break, for our second break. All Other comments? Other comments? Boy, perhaps a break isn't even going to be necessary. You can collect your thoughts, but let's double back a little bit. And Mr. Harder had some specific questions that I promised him we would get back to. So at this time, while folks are collecting their thoughts, we're going to look to Mr. Kennecke, Mr. Jones, and their team. We had a number of questions. I wrote some of them down, but Mr. Jones, if you've got them, you can sort of take them. And
Commissioner Johnson, I wonder if a break isn't a good time for us to set up for we were going to respond to Ms. Anderson's comments, and so while doing that, I certainly can also respond to the other issues that have come up. So I look for your direction on.
Okay, I'm going to make the suggestion, subject to other my colleagues redirecting me here. If there are other comments, let's take them. And then once we've heard from you all, we'll take a short break. We'll come back. We'll get TransCanada on the record, make sure we get the information out to you that you've asked. But we will want to give them, 10 minutes to – we'll want to give Sherry 10 minutes. We'll also want to give them 10 minutes to pull their information together. So before making those of you who don't want to wait around for that wait, let's see if you've got other comments or questions. Mr. Harder, since you're going to be around anyway to get your questions answered, let's pause on you for a little bit, and then let's see if anybody else has anything, because we can always take you after the break because we know you'll be around. This isn't your last opportunity. Commissioner Colbeck did mention that, of course, there are opportunities to get your written comments in yet for quite a while prior to commission decision, at least weeks. A few. Yes. Let's get you to the mic, Mr. Harder, if you've got a quick question.
What is the last date that we can enter our public comments?
From a practical standpoint, public comments, can affect the commission's decision right up until the point where they vote. We have not yet set a date for a decision. There is a statutory deadline, but with the time frame that we're on, we may not exhaust that timeline. Here's what I think, and Mr. Smith or others will correct me. We'll complete the hearing this week. The parties will almost certainly, and I think commissioners will want them to take the opportunity for written briefs, for them to brief the legal issues surrounding the testimony that was introduced this week. It is not unusual for parties to want sometime a couple of weeks or more to do that, then it would not be unusual for the commission to want a couple of weeks or more to consider those written briefs before rendering a decision. At the very tightest time frame, I think a decision would be far more than a month off. Mr. Smith?
I agree. Probably more than that, yes.
Yeah, I'm really trying to be very conservative in my estimate. Commissioners Hansen, Colbeck, any?
No, unless a person is an intervener, there are different rules for interveners, but for the public, certainly we've been receiving, throughout the entire duration, we've been receiving emails and letters, things of that nature, and if we receive them, they'll be part of the public record. So if you want to get those to us, obviously sooner the better in case there's a response that you're asking for.
If memory serves, it was 2 months from the deadline, from the hearing on the Big Stone 2 case before we released a decision, and it was 2 months from the hearing on the Keystone pipeline before we released a decision. Does that jive with what you remember, Mr. Smith?
I think it was considerably longer than that in the case of Keystone. I'm going to say, and by decision, I'm taking that to mean your vote as opposed to the writing of an order like this is a job, let me tell you. My recollection, Commissioner, is that it was pretty close to 90 days, I believe, before the commission voted. We had an extended briefing schedule, and but it may be different this time.
No, I think that's right. I think your recollection is closer to mine. So, Mr. Harder, I don't think we're looking at coming out with anything next week. That's for sure.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
A point of interest to the audience may be the fact that under state law, we are required to make a decision within 1 year after the filing. It's not a, so if at any point you feel that things are being rushed along or something of that nature, we're trying to meet statutory deadlines here. And we're certainly not trying to rush. We're trying to make certain that everybody has an opportunity to make presentation to us. But we do have a deadline that we're required to meet under the state legislature.
Excellent point. Comments? Questions? Well, with that, we will go ahead and take a short break. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, Representative Wink.
Representative from District 29. I'm wearing basically three hats tonight. I come here mostly to listen, but just a comment. One, I would like to applaud the commission for your latitude in giving people the opportunity to for public testimony. It's great that everybody has a chance to have their say. I come here as a landowner. I have a ranch in Meade County. And the Trans-Canada will have its pipeline going down through part of my ranch. So I come here as with that's one hat. I'm a former county commissioner, and I think the concerns of the counties with their county roads are very important. I think you need to really keep that in mind. And thirdly, as a state representative, I can see the benefits, and I'm sure you can too. The potential that this pipeline has for the state of South Dakota. And so I think you have a tough decision. But I would just ask that you not let the benefits to the state overshadow the concerns that the counties have and that the landowners have. I'm sure you're well aware, we take private property rights very seriously in western South Dakota. And I did introduce a bill last year. If I asked you to do one thing, I would say look at the perpetual easement. I did introduce a bill last year in the legislature. It didn't make it out of committee. It was pointed out by several attorneys representing natural gas companies and oil companies, some of the flaws in the language, and looking at it closely, I agreed and withdrew the bill. But I do think that it's a travesty to have a perpetual easement for this oil pipeline. I do think that putting a timeline on the length of the useful life of the pipeline is in order, and that you would limit the easement to that lifetime. If there's one thing I would ask you to do, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
I do want to good-naturedly rib you about the person who had the biggest problem with our speakers, with our sound system tonight, was the person who paid for it and uses it professionally at least 2 months a year. So, other comments?
You do understand, Chairman, that he has our purse strings every.
good-naturedly was the first two words of my comments.
I'm just happy that Commissioner Johnson, Buffalo County Commissioner, got to see a real live Democrat in person again tonight. It says you don't get to see him out there very much.
Other comments? Well, before we take a break, I'll just say quickly, this has really been impressive. People kept their comments, I think, very succinct, to the point, stayed focused by and large on issues that are part of the commission's concern. I think there were very legitimate issues raised, and I will tell you that comments that were raised during the first three public input hearings have been mentioned as we've gone through this proceeding just in the last 2 days. Things that you all and folks that you live with and work with mentioned have been brought up by commissioners specifically in questions. So this is not all for vain. This does become part of the process, even if it's not evidence in the strictest sense. if we hear it, it's not like it just goes away. So thank you for your time, and I know we're not done. We are coming back after a 10-minute break, but since some of you may want to hit the road, did want to make that clear, and since I took the personal attitude, maybe I'll see if Commissioners Hansen or Colbeck have anything else to add.
No, other than to say thank you very much for your time. It makes a difference, and we appreciate it.
So with that, let's... it is 17 after. We will return at 27 after 9 and attempt to get started again. Thanks. We will be off the web until 27 after the record. Okay, we are back on the record and back on the Internet. The applicant has asked to respond to some of the concerns raised by Mr. Harder, Ms. Anderson, and some other people generally about violations of the Commission's order with the first pipeline. We have agreed to give them some limited latitude. We understand it's late, but to the extent that you can move through this information and to the extent that it's valuable, we're happy to hear it. So the clock is running, and we are interested in what you have to say. Proceed.
Thank you very much, Commissioner Brett Kennecke for TransCanada. I have some copies of the presentation Mr. Fuhrer and Mr. Gray are about to make. I'll make some of them available to commissioners and some of them available to parties in the room as well, and we'd like to proceed.
Yeah, and it's probably also worth noting for those folks listening on the web that we do have a presentation that is up on the television screens here in the state capitol. Mr. Kennecke, this presentation, will put this on the web unless you indicate we should not, and so people will be able to access it very shortly tomorrow. It'll be provided in electronic form. So, great. Proceed.
All right. My name is Paul Fuhrer, project manager for the Keystone Construction in South Dakota. Just provide a quick restoration update. First slide just shows the 6 to 8 inches of rain in October that was more than normal. The route of the Keystone pipeline through South Dakota. Probably the two counties there that have the wettest areas, Marshall and Beadle County. There's an article that talks about the 9.45 inches above the 100-year average from June through September. I don't think that we need to belabor the fact that it's been very wet in this area. First shot is a picture of 416th Avenue, just south of 113th Street, where the road has been closed throughout much of the summer because of the saturated conditions there. Picture of looking south from 108th Street at restored right-of-way in Marshall County. This right-of-way was restored in June. This is 108th Street, where approximately where the pipeline crosses the road. This is at 111th Street, looking towards Highway 10. This is some right-of-way that's being restored when the subsoil is saturated. There has been damage to the roads. We are very cognizant of that. Where many of these areas are, you can see in this particular photo where it is wetlands on both sides, a low spot in the road. As that's used for construction, it does require constant maintenance and will require some additional effort at the end of construction. Again, restored right-of-way in Day County, approximately 130th Street, County Road 4. Looking the opposite side of 130th Street in Day County. About 8 miles further down the road, restored right-of-way in Day County. The road at 138th Street. Evidence of the fresh surfacing that's been placed where the pipeline crossed the road. Looking the other way at 138th Street, restored right-of-way. It's restored right-of-way looking from South Dakota Highway 28, looking north into Clark County. Looking south into Beadle County, restored right-of-way. The facility in the background is the Carpenter Pump Station. This is 190th Street. Actually, this is Carpenter Road. This is the road that the photo Ms. Anderson had of the where the road had been pretty well driven out. We have spent considerable expense and time there, and this was the road as of last Wednesday. Restored right away at 191st Street, 415th Avenue in Beadle County. This is a minimum maintenance road at 191st Street. During construction, this road had much deeper ruts. It's been somewhat maintained, and as the construction is finished there, we are working with the township to properly restore that road. Restored right away in Beadle County. This is a road in Beadle County that was not used by the pipeline. Restored right away in Beadle County, 196th Street.
I just have a quick question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yes. While we're looking at all these restored right-of-ways, is this stuff that you planted or is this stuff that the landowner planted?
It's a combination. In some places, we planted a cover crop, and in others, the landowner went in and planted either a cover crop or a crop that he then cut, baled, or made what use he could of it.
Okay. Who makes that decision?
It's a combination. Our environmental folks will determine what the proper restoration is and reseeding, and then they it's either worked out with the landowner for them to do it, or our construction crews do that as part of the reclamation.
Okay. Who has ultimate control over that, the landowner or the environmental person?
Well, I would say that our requirements for the project under the reclamation plan govern, and then it's a matter of what's the most efficient way to accomplish that.
Okay. But the landowner's included, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Sorry to interrupt.
That's fine. Beadle County Road, again, showing that the roads have been used. Also, the truck, the grain truck coming in the background there, I guess just to show that there are other folks using those roads other than us in these areas. Restored right away at 198th Street. Showing a piece of equipment, the paraplow to do the deep ripping of the subsoil, and the harrow to break up the topsoil when it's been spread over the right away. And restored right away in McCook County. This picture was taken as it was raining last week. And that's the slides. Thank you.
Thank you. Very, very quick, Mr. Fuhrer. Appreciate it. Did you have specific comments in response, Mr. Jones, Mr. Kennecke?
Sir, I look for your guidance. It's late in the evening. I know that a lot of these questions are addressed during the hearing procedures and have been put on record before, but if you wish, I can go through them. I look for your guidance on that.
Well, I mean, I do think these people are sticking around for some reason, and it's not because I'm very good looking. So my thought would be let's do a little bit of triage here. We've had a lot of issues raised. I don't expect that you'll address all of them, but let's start with taking the three or four that rise to the top in your mind, and then we'll check with folks that ask questions, and if they're important ones that didn't get answered, we'll double back.
That's great, because there were certainly a number of questions that were left unanswered. We did that intentionally because this really is the evening for other folks to come in and speak. One of the questions was, how do you bend pipe? Commissioner Hansen and I have been out to the right-of-way together, and he's been able to witness how we safely bend pipe. It is a specialized machine that uses an anvil inside the pipe, and then is only allowed to make a computer bend in degrees, and it's a very effective tool, but it allows us to keep the contours of the right-of-way. So certainly also not unconventional. It's very, very conventional to bend pipe.
So, Mr. Jones, earlier tonight you mentioned 40,000 miles of pipeline. I mean, let's get specific. To the extent that you've had failures on those pipelines, have they been located at have those failures been at bend locations?
There's no uniqueness with regards to bends whatsoever, no.
Okay, thank you.
there was a question with regards to, you know, does pipe float and why are you, putting those saddles on? So when you're in very saturated soils, even swamps or muskeg, the pipe without the oil in it requires some buoyancy resistance. And so those concrete saddles are put on top of the pipe so that it prevents it from lifting. There was talk about this pipe floated out of the ground. I can assure you that it did not float out of the ground until it had those saddles on it that allowed it to be secured to the bottom of the ditch. Do saddles require heavier wall pipe? They do not. However, they tend to be in what we call HCAs or in wetlands anyways, so the pipe's traditionally designed to a different design factor. Does the diameter matter? 30-inch versus 36-inch? And again, I'm being quick here, Sherry. I'm sorry. I apologize for speaking so quickly. I'm just trying to be cognizant of the time. Pipelines are built safely well into the 52, 56, 58 diameter. In Russia, they've got those kind of diameters. In North America, pipelines traditionally don't get any larger than 48-inch. They're all regulated by PHMSA. They have the same code. There is no safety difference, whether it's a 12-inch diameter or it's a 48-inch diameter. It's the same code and the same regulation. I'm not even going to respond to the Tripp County official. I think that's, as we know, fairly inappropriate and it does not occur. Welding in the rain. I can tell you for the Keystone XL project, we're going to use automatic welding units. These sit in shacks, so even if it is raining, the rain doesn't impact the weld. Even if you have a weld that is outside and exposed to the rain, this pipe is preheated to well over hundreds of degrees Fahrenheit. Like I don't know the exact numbers, but the pipe needs to be preheated before it's welded, and then every weld is 100% inspected and then retested with water. So there is very little concern about welding in rain because of the intense heat and then the additional testing that is done. But typically, if it rains too much, you just can't physically get the welding done, and so you then bring in tarps or umbrellas to keep the rain off the welders. The debate about tar sands or oil sands being using the most energy to be able to extract the bitumen from the sand has actually been now proven to be no different than unconventional oil that is derived from other sources. So, in fact, if you even compare oil sands crude to California, an independent study has shown that the energy required to extract that crude oil from California is no different than in the oil sands. And one of the advancements is in technologies, and is being driven by some of the legislation, is to reduce the energy component required to be able to extract the bitumen out of the sand and then convert it to crude oil. The emergency response plan was another question. We've already filed the oil spill response plan with the PUC, and it has been approved by PHMSA. That will be the template for the Keystone XL emergency response plan, and we are going to commence detail activities with PHMSA on that in the start of the year. It has to be filed and approved even before the pipeline can begin operation. There was a question I asked about educating the citizens with regards to the pipeline safety. This is a great question, and we really feel we're a member of the community. We have an ongoing relationship with members of the community, and we do get actively involved and meet with, for example, fire departments, police departments, county commissioners. And over time, we revisit them, and this is an ongoing process that we continue to do through the life of the pipeline. That's my list, Commissioner Johnson. Did I miss anything?
Those are the big issues that I'd sort of indicated we needed to get follow-up on, but let's see if... Yeah, go ahead, Commissioner.
I remember pipe temp. There was some question about the long root alfalfa and how hot the pipe gets in the buried ground. Could you address that?
Oh, sorry. Yes. Okay. Yeah. There was a lot of debate today about pipe depth of cover. The code is 30 inches. This pipeline's minimum depth of cover will be 48 inches. And because of that, then the oil, which, by the way, is not heated, there's a misconception sometimes that the oil is heated at its processing in Alberta, but it's not. The oil has ground temperature, but when it goes through a pump station, it does heat up because of the energy that is impressed in the oil as it goes through the pump station. But because it's 4 feet down and it's insulated by the ground, which is ground temperature, by the time that bulb reaches maybe even a foot, the temperature is significantly knocked down. And there are hundreds of thousands of pipelines throughout the United States, and I'm not aware of any significant long-term issues with root crops. And there's people that are, I'm not an expert in this, but I'm advised that there is very small or unlikely chance that there will ever be a problem with root crops.
And then the other one that I remember is the non-sufficient fund check. Is there any, how what are the means that people get paid by you? Could they get a cashier's check, or how is that taken care of?
Buster, you probably know that answer better than I do. I don't know. I believe that our land man has the ability to write a check, and I'm not aware that any checks that have been NSF or anything.
I think one of the I think Deborah had mentioned that she's just worried about getting an NSF check, and I'm curious as to know is what are the options to alleviate that concern. Could you get a cashier's check or
as far as payment?
Yeah. Yep.
Mr. Gray, perhaps let's have you introduce yourself.
Thanks.
Hello. Oh, okay. Yep. My name's L.A. Buster Gray, and I'm the construction manager over the Keystone Phase 1 pipeline project in eastern South Dakota. The land agents that work for us, I believe that the monetary value of their authority is $30,000 if they can write a check. I would have to verify that amount, but I believe it's $30,000 on occurrence. Anything greater than that has to be processed through a financial institution in Calgary for payment to be made directly from the bank that's there. But to my knowledge, over the past 2 years, we've not written a bad check.
And that's, I don't claim to have authority over that. I just, that was one of the
I'm not aware that this is an issue in any of the states that we've crossed.
Okay.
All right, well, this is not really billed as a Q&A session, but again, we do want to let informality rule to the extent it can. So if someone's got an issue that they want to raise and have TransCanada address, we're happy to take some time for that. Yeah, Mr. Johnson, let's get you to a mic just so we'll kick Mr. Fuhrer to the curb here and...
The question was brought up, how much weight can you go over the pipeline? I believe Dave Neamey or somebody brought that up, and I guess that was a concern. I guess I was just wondering what that might be.
No, that's a great question, weight limits over the pipeline. Excellent one.
So, yes, my understanding is the question is, and I've heard of, in many of these hearings, is, can my farm tractor, can any of my farm implements go cross safely over the pipeline? And the answer is yes. If you're concerned at all that... there's a depth of cover problem, and you should certainly give us a call. We have a website or 1-800 number, but I'm not aware of any conventional farm implement that can't cross the pipeline, considering, again, the 4 feet minimum depth of cover that we're going to build this pipeline to.
Is there a specific weight limit?
I knew you were going to ask me that, and I don't know the specific weight limit, but I'm confident there is, and that conventional farm implements, any axle load can cross the pipeline. If you consider the conditions that would be a problem, which would be obviously desaturated soil conditions, you couldn't move that grain truck anyway. So when, you know, the kind of the rule of thumb is, if you can move it across your land, then you can cross the pipeline. We assume you cross it at 90 degrees or 45 degrees, and you wouldn't run parallel the whole way and get it all rutted up. But even if you did, I'm not aware of any conventional farm equipment that would damage the pipeline.
So let's, I mean, that's a really good way to put it. So in your experience, and I know you're not under oath here, but I mean, has TransCanada had an instance when farm machinery has damaged a pipeline, has caused a pipeline failure?
Certainly not caused a pipeline failure. Where we get concerned about is just stress, and then do we need to go and have a look at it? So we have had an occasion where somebody took like a D6 or D8 CAT, and they were building a road or something, and they all of a sudden went off their went onto the easement with that D8 CAT in wet conditions and struck the line. I've personally experienced this, and we ended up having to investigate. First of all, you had to get the cat off the pipe, had to shut down the line, had to safely bring in a crane to move this D8 cat, and then we had to dig up the pipeline, inspect it for any damage, and repair it on site, and it was successfully done.
That's when there was a striking?
That's correct.
Okay. Questions? And not just questions, certainly if there are comments, we didn't tell you couldn't make comments when we come back, so we want to hear from you if you've got any. Go ahead. Mr. Nimi. Sorry, Commissioner Colbeck.
No, will this pipeline be manufactured, it's a pipe manufactured in the United States?
Mr. Jones?
This Keystone XL pipe, we are in the middle of doing the final negotiations for acquiring the pipe. I can tell you that right now the overwhelming majority of this pipeline will be fabricated in the United States and with in North America, and with steel that is also in North America. There's been a big change in, as you know, the economy over the last certainly last year. And when we were building the original pipeline, all the pipe mills and all the steel manufacturing in North America was saturated. Now we are finding that the mills in North America have got capacity, and we are taking advantage of that. So the overwhelming majority of this pipeline will be fabricated in North America.
Okay, great. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
By saturated, do you mean you couldn't buy it in America if you wanted to on the first pipe?
Yes, thank you for that clarification, Commissioner Colbeck. The market was saturated, so the North American steel pipe market was saturated. We had to go offshore.
Okay.
Okay, well, any final comments or questions? Mr. Harder.
First thing I'd want to address is that I did not say you wined and dined Trip County commissioners. It happened in a different county that I was told this. The second one is that my question about bending the pipeline, I kind of had an idea how they do it because I figured it was a glorified pipe bender. Okay, so that was pretty simple, and that's pretty much what he stated. My question was, does it change the original strength of the pipeline? I would say, from what I've seen of bending pipelines and the ones we did were aluminum, had aluminum in them, which allowed them to bend and keep their form. And they were probably bent to sharper turns than what they're doing. But when you bend steel, it does change how it's connected. I mean, that's just common sense. So does it change the original strength of the steel?
Well, I was thinking exactly like you were, which is why I asked specifically, you know, let's talk about specific real-world statistics, and, you know, we'll give the applicant an opportunity to respond. But, you know, I asked, well, tell me, I mean, have that's where the failures have been, because, Mr. Harder, I was thinking like you are. Mr. Jones, anything to add?
Again, the code's very specific about this. There's limits with regards to how much you're allowed to bend the pipe, and so those limits are designed so that the remaining molecular properties are well exceed the standard we need to operate the line.
Okay. Do you have some more?
Yes. Okay.
Then let's go ahead and get all your questions, and we make some efficiencies in how they answer them that way.
Okay. One of the reasons that I'm quite, I guess you can say, emotional or whatever about what's going on here is the economic downturn that I think that happened in this country was in large part to high oil prices. So with that in mind, we've seen cattle prices drop over $40 a hundred. That took a significant impact on our operation, and with the benefit, with the fact of building a new house at the same time, it wasn't a good deal. So if I have no love for oil companies, I guess now you understand why. Next question is, why do some of the contracts with some of the people have to have gag orders put on them? I guess you already stated that about the information for a longer input. I'm kind of a slow typer, so. And then something that I'd like to add is that each pipeline location where you put your sign up, put a phone number on the sign. Then the last thing is that the way it was stated to me is that when TransCanada comes in, they buy the line and we get to use it. Thank you.
Sure, and I think we've had the legal answer to that last one, but let's go ahead and get comments on phone numbers on signs and contracts with gag orders.
All the road crossing signs have the 1-800 number on them, Commissioner.
Okay. Did you want to address the contract issue?
I don't understand the question, and I don't believe it's an appropriate question. I'm not aware of any gag orders.
Mr. Harder, are you talking about vendors or are you talking about landowners?
Can you restate your question?
Are you talking about easement agreements with landowners, or are you talking about contracts with vendors and contractors doing work for the applicant?
I'm talking about easement agreements with landowners.
Okay, great, perfect. Mr. Jones, to what extent are there gag orders in the landowner easement agreement?
There's nothing in the easement that I'm aware of that precludes discussion.
Okay. Other questions? I think we've done really a very good job of not being redundant. I mean, people have really unearthed different issues and have not done a good job of covering a lot of ground tonight. Other questions or comments? Other questions or comments? Other questions or comments? Hearing none, it's been mentioned a couple of times, but we'll reiterate it so that you understand that we understand. You're real people, you have real lives, and certainly thank you for making time for this process. And with that, we'll see if Commissioner Hansen or Commissioner Colbeck have anything to add. With that, we will call to a close this public input meeting. Thank you. Have a good night.
Commissioner Johnson, just before you close, can I just...
Oh, hold on, everyone. My apologies. Mr. Jones wanted to make another comment before we draw to a close here. Yes, Mr. Jones?
I just want to thank the commissioners and the staff of the Public Utilities Commission for hosting this session and having all these folks here this evening and their ongoing work to evaluate this important public utility. I also want to thank all you folks for coming here tonight and taking the time here this evening to share your concerns.
We could have it quiet in the back. Mr. Jones is still speaking. Thank you.
You know, we do hear your concerns. We hear them loud and clear. We understand your priorities for your land, your family, your communities, and your country. But building a pipeline is complex, and it's an important utility for the interest of the nation. You know, we clear the topsoil, dig a trench,
200-300 miles across the state. We haul, weld, bury, and test pipe that requires things that you normally don't do on your land. However, once this work is finished and there's many, all these miles of pipeline are in the ground, the roads will be repaired and the land will be restored to its productivity as best as we can. You know, we're finishing construction on the east side of the state, and we'll continue to work to restore the roads and put the land back together appropriately. In respect to the new pipeline, you have my commitment on behalf of Keystone and of TransCanada that we will design and construct this pipeline and operate this pipeline safely and in an environmentally responsible manner. And we'll work, continue to work constantly to treat landowners with fairness and respect. We've heard this evening about some of the benefits of this project. We know that we're committed to being a good neighbor and making a positive difference in the community in which you live and work. We have established a direct link between this pipeline, this Keystone XL pipeline, will ensure a direct link between the secure, safe, reliable crude oil source from Canada to the markets here in the U.S. So I thank you very much again for your time. Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you to the applicant. Everyone, travel safely, and we will resume our formal hearing tomorrow morning at 8:30 in this room. Good night.